against attacks on public worker rights. She says one important issue for her is equal pay for women.
Women still earn less for doing the same work than the male co-workers do. And Congress has a chance to further close the gap by passing the Paycheck Fairness Act. And AFSCME strongly supports this legislation. So this is an exciting time for me to come in and to lead the fight in solidarity and to make sure that we stand up for workers in this country, that we stand up for women and social and economic justice.
Federally contracted low-wage workers are on the move again in Washington, D.C. They plan a strike, protests, and civil disobedience at the Ronald Reagan Building and the old post office pavilion. It's a protest against wage theft as the workers call on President Obama to guarantee a living wage and a voice on the job for federally contracted workers. 2 million workers, many of them low-wage, work for the federal government through private contractors. Oakland, California city employees and BART system workers both launched separate strikes on Monday to bring attention to pay and security concerns. Jesse Russell reports.
Public transit in the Bay Area nearly ground to a halt on Monday as workers called a strike against the Bay Area Transit Authority. In addition to the transit strike, thousands of Oakland City employees walked off the job over their own stalled contract negotiations. The city workers made substantial concessions to the city during the economic downturn, and the workers have accused Oakland Mayor Jean Kwan of not joining in negotiations. So even though she offered a cost of living increase this weekend, they still decided to strike. SEIU Local 1021 Oakland Chapter President Dwight McElroy told the crowd that the strike was about more than negotiations.
The individuals who are hired at the city of Oakland who have no work rights, who have no health care, who have no benefits. Somebody got to start speaking up and say, you cannot continue to mistreat these individuals.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show on the road, the highways and byways of America, the beautiful. What an amazing trip this has been, the people's tour for America. What we found, and I've got Pat LaMarche here in the passenger seat with me as we travel the roads. As we look across this country, we've seen some absolute beauty and some poverty as well.
Oh, an awful lot of poverty. I mean, we're seeing the poorest the country's been, certainly since the Great Depression, and probably at all. The difference is we have some supports now. We have some unemployment compensation, and we have some food stamps. Well, we have them for now. And our elderly are cared for to some degree.
For now.
Yeah, and to some degree, not well. I had a guy in my homeless shelter who had a minimum wage job his whole life. Back when minimum wage was 75 cents an hour. So he doesn't get much of a payment, about $580 a month to live on.
And which I don't know how you do.
Which is why he lived in a homeless shelter. That's where we want our 80-year-olds? Is that where we want them to end up? Certainly he had been a honorably discharged member of the United States military. Never had much of an education, and just basically spent his whole life doing servile jobs for other people and never made a break, you know. That's what happens. If you don't have a good job with some good benefits and something to look forward to.
But what is, you keep hearing this a lot, if you had a good job. What is a good job in your view?
Well, I mean, if you're going to talk my idea of a good job, meaning all bets off, it would be a job that in addition to being able to make you whole today, you would be able to be whole in your retirement, and on top of that, you would enjoy your work. I think being happy at work is a really important thing. One of the coal miners I interviewed a couple of months ago when I was in West Virginia, I asked him how he liked being down in the mines, and he said, I loved it. I loved being down there. I loved the job. I mean, that's an important part of having, I mean, how much of your life do you spend at work?
Just third, if not more.
Yeah. I mean, you spend an enormous amount of your time asleep, you know, and the rest of the time you spend running back and forth. But for the most part, the one big constant is that you're going to be working, hopefully, at something you enjoy.
Yeah, and you know, today on the program, we're in Kansas City, Missouri. We're going to be talking about the first sit-down strike, which happened in Kansas City at the first Ford Motor Company local there in Kansas City, Local 249. We're going to talk to a couple of their retirees and some folks from there about the job. And the thing that really stuck out to me in talking with these auto workers is the pride aspect of this. The fact that, you know, they built something. Their time meant something. And you could see that in the conversations we had with them.
Yeah, I mean, these are definitely guys who love their work, love their job, liked it better when it got to be a better existence. You know, we were talking to them about things like the 1937 Ford strike, when they were striking for things like the ability to go to the bathroom, the ability to eat lunch.
But here's the thing, Pat. I mean, even to this day, that fight continues. You know, there was just a story, I guess a month or two before we started the tour, about a Verizon call center worker, a woman who was pregnant, who they made take vacation time when she had to go to the bathroom. I mean, think about that. In this day and age, you know, when people say, well, you know, that was a fight, you know, almost 100 years ago, that's still going on.
I'll tell you what, I've been a substitute teacher for a long time. You know, every time I needed work, I could fall back on being a substitute teacher. I used to be a regular teacher. And teachers don't get to go to the bathroom either, and that's still current. And, you know, are you really going to
go? She can't raise her hand?
Are you really going to go to the bathroom and leave 25 five-year-olds in the room?
Yeah, I never thought of that.
Yeah, well, guess what? You aren't. It's a miracle every teacher alive doesn't have a bladder infection and failing kidneys.
Or wearing diapers.
Yeah, like, I put up that thing about the auto workers, and a friend of mine whose grandmother worked in the, or mom worked in the woolen mills in Maine said, yeah, my mom said she wore diapers to work and kept sandwiches in her pockets because they weren't allowed to eat.
It's amazing what we've allowed to happen. It's amazing that we allow those conditions to exist. And, you know, in talking with the auto workers today and talking with workers we've talked to across the country, we can change those things. I mean, that's the important part of all this, and the reason that I think it's important that we talk about it, because we can change it.
Right, and we can. If we wait for somebody else to, it's not going to happen. We've got to take that, and there have to be a lot of us. Alone, we're pretty weak, but when we work together, like anything, I mean, when you think about great relief efforts, when you think about, you know, say a church has decided to send packages to the soldiers, that's not done by one person. That's done by a whole pile of people in the church who say, okay, this is something we want to do. And it takes all those people working together. And why it seems okay to work in a cooperative way for something like that, but then you're ridiculed for working in a cooperative fashion when what you're really hoping to do is make your life better and the better of the lives better of the people you work with. I don't understand. It's the same exact thing, and it makes the same kind of sense.
Yeah, and also tonight on the program, we're talking to Judy Ansel, good friend of the program, someone we've had on in the past. She also runs the Heartland Radio Forum and has been on the air there in the Kansas City area for many, many years. We're going to talk about the garment industry and what happened with that, the jobs that were lost, the hard-fought battles over generations to make the garment industry a, well, maybe not a living wage job, but at least one you could exist on, and, well, with a little bit of safety. And in the third hour, we're going to talk about our time at the Eisenhower Presidential Library, which I just loved. I mean, we were able to go to the Eisenhower one. We got to sit down with their deputy director, and also got to go to the Truman Library, which, you know, I saw a shirt in the Eisenhower Library that said Truman or Eisenhower Truman 2012. And I thought that was fairly interesting.
Yeah, two men with similar ideals separated by a political party, I think was what it said on the T-shirt. Certainly two men that are both way far left of anything we've got in leadership for the country right now.
Yeah, as I've said, you know, Dwight David Eisenhower, the socialist Republican. Because, you know, by today's standards, he would have been a commie.
All of the Republicans be from Eisenhower back were socialists. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt is the guy who gave us the National Park Service, where we've been lucky to be winding our way around all across this country. Are you kidding? I mean, we're going to take all this land and we're going to put it in the public trust? Socialism!
Yeah, we should be giving that to the corporations so they can charge us to go in and out.
And then, of course, I mean, if you want to think of other Republicans, it's really interesting. I'm reading Traitor to His Class, the story of FDR, and one of the things it talks about is, except for Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt was the first president, Democratic president, after Lincoln. There were nothing but Republicans. The country was so darn happy with President Lincoln and the job that the Republicans had done in eliminating slavery, that they literally rode that coattail, with the exception of Woodrow Wilson, all the way to FDR.
Well, I got to be honest, bring me back those policies. Bring me that vision for the future that the party of Lincoln had, and I would vote for it.
Absolutely.
And the problem is this Republican Party, today's GOP, is nowhere recognizable. And the party of Lincoln.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, you can recognize it. It's the party of Mussolini. Mussolini, the man who gave us the word fascism.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Corporate control of the government. And I got to tell you, enough of those blue dog Democrats, throw them right in there, too. Because they're all for corporate control of the government as well.
And also in the third hour, we went to the Ed Asner press conference while he was in Kansas City, did a one-man show of FDR, which I'm actually dying to see. But we had some really real good conversation during the press conference. Going to talk about the things that we learned, the event that happened, and a whole bunch of Ed Asner, which
he was like. Yeah, he was so adorable with the football players from his. The team he played for in high school, great big bruising, huge kids, kept asking him their weight. And then at one point he looked at one of the kids and said, "My skin's turning purple just looking at you."
Yeah, they were some big kids.
Yeah. Just thought about hitting them and thought, oh, my God.
Yeah, but graduated in 1947.
I know. He's no spring chicken, but, boy, he's adorable.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what a flirt. Says to the principal of his old high school, "Give me a kiss. You know I like women."
Well, you know, when you get to be that age,
you get away with that.
You get away with that.
Especially when you played Santa on Elf.
Yeah.
You know, he was Santa on Elf. He was the old fella on Up. And of course, Lou Grant on Mary Tyler Moore. I mean, just so many wonderful, charming characters he's played. Just a delightful. It was great. I thought it was great fun to sit there. Yeah. It was like we had a one-man show as well.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
Ed Asner playing Ed Asner.
And that was a wonderful thing. We'll talk about that. Also going to talk about a couple of emails, some thoughts. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our tour, peoplestourforamerica.com. right back from the road. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's 97 crosses planted in the cold ash yard. 97 families put off 97 farms. I think about my grandpa. My neighbors and my name. It's the nice to feel like that.
It goes back to the fundamentals, intoned a Wall Street analyst. The economy is improving. Improving for whom? By fundamentals, he means the high-flying stock market, booming corporate profits, and top executive pay. Those are signs of an economy that is top-heavy, not healthy. In fact, our economy is teetering dangerously because it's not sustained from below by a strong middle class. Economist Paul Krugman notes that far from improving, our economy remains in a low-grade depression. Of course, that thermometer zooms to a high grade if you're among the millions of Americans who are jobless, working for low wages, or able to get only part-time temporary employment. Yes, the unemployment rate has ticked down, but not because of any jump in job creation. Rather, the dismal lack of hiring has become so discouraging that many people simply give up the hunt, which magically removes them from the ranks of the unemployed. Most Congress critters clearly don't care about America's middle-class jobs depression. The White House cares, but doesn't treat it as the crisis it is, so nothing happens. The only jobs push we've had is the stopgap effort by the Federal Reserve to pump enough money into the economy to keep unemployment from worsening. But rather than push harder, Ben Bernanke, head of the central bank, recently sounded retreat. He, too, uses the faulty unemployment statistic as a crutch to claim improvement. The jobless rate, he says, could drop to 7% next year, so the Fed stimulus will no longer be needed. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's shameful. Even if that was the true rate, 7% equals 11 million unemployed Americans and many millions more who would still be underemployed. From Bernanke to Congress, all government officials who shrug their shoulders and give up on helping that many Americans should themselves be made jobless.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. The People's Tour for America has rolled into Kansas City. Yes, we've made it all the way to the coast and, well, most of the way back here to Kansas City, all the way to the West Coast.
There's a coast in Kansas City?
Well, we made it all the way to the California coast, and now we're heading back, rolled through Kansas City. We've made it to the UAW local, 249 here, the first Ford local, Pat.
That's my one. And that makes it my first question, because why isn't it UAW1?
That's a good question. That's why we've got Phil Brown here. He's a recording secretary for the retiree chapter of the local, also the former historian. Phil, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. The designation of numbers was left up to the locals. They could be any number they wanted as long as another local didn't have it. In fact, is there is one local, I believe it's here in Missouri, it's called 1999, and that was because it was formed in 1999. So there you have it.
So why 249?
Don't know.
Okay.
That's about the honest I can be with that. I really don't. The people who did that are no longer living, so I don't know.
But this is, you know, January 15th of 1937.
Correct.
An awful long time ago, and you're sitting in front of a picture of one of the greatest moments in labor history. You know, you go back to the sit-down strikes, and when we think of those, we think of Detroit, not Kansas City.
That's correct. Detroit, in fact, was the breaking point for Henry Ford. In 1941, the UAW took on Ford at the Rouge plant, which would have been local 600. And they figured if they could hurt Henry Ford there by going on strike, then they could, in fact, make it instrumental for the whole Ford system to be organized. And that's exactly what happened. All the effort was on the Rouge plant. When it succumbed, or when Henry Ford agreed to recognize the UAW, then everybody else followed suit.
Take me back to, you know, the period of this, the sit-down strikes. What were the working conditions like? What was the job like at Ford before organizing and before the unions?
It was hot during the summer months. There was no fans available. Most of the time, the windows were closed. There was no smoking inside the plant whatsoever. And so you can imagine the era then, you know, most everyone did smoke. You know, it was like when I grew up, my generation, we all smoked. But working conditions were horrific, you know, when the line did break down, and that did happen on occasion, even when I was at work. And so when that did occur, they had a whistle that they blew, and your time actually stopped. And if it was down for very long, they leave the plant. And there was a park across the street from the old Winchester plant that people stood in and waited for the line to get moving again. And when it did start up again, they bring them all back in, but your time stopped. It was emphasized when you hired in that you were expected to get so many minutes of production that day, regardless of how long it took. If it took 10 hours to get 8 hours production, then that's what you got paid for, only the 8, but you worked 10. If you were down, you were stayed there for 12 hours to get your production, you still only got paid for that 8 hours worth of work.
You know, it's interesting. We hear an awful lot about Henry Ford. You know, he was this. He's the guy who brought the $5 a day wage. And you know, we look back and he was this. You know, this benevolent leader and this benevolent CEO, and that's not quite accurate, is it?
No, it isn't. You know, for what it's worth, Henry Ford did good. It was the era in which he lived. I mean, you know, I'll go back and I will say this is my own opinion that he was one of the three of the robber barons. You had Dale Carnegie, you had the Rockefellers, you had Henry Ford. And the worker was looked on as a commodity that could be, when it broke down, it was discarded, another one took the place of it. And so that was the way he was. I mean, I know for a fact, I have a book that a friend of mine that I was in the service with, he lives in Richmond Hill, Georgia. And Henry Ford, in fact, built the town of Richmond Hill, Georgia. And you go there, and I've been there, the streets are named after him, his plantation is down there. Turpentine production was a big thing then, but there was such a glut of it that it was worth nothing. Okay? But he kept the production going, because he kept the people working down there. And he just took it upon himself to create that town and help the people. So, like I said, he did do some good thing. The $5 a day, you mentioned that. And
a lot of people mention it. It seems to be, you know, you've pointed him out as one of the robber barons, and it's part of that myth that these folks were benevolent and that there was no self-interest.
Okay, so let's say what the $5 a day was.
The $5 a day was... Henry figured that instead of working sick days, if he paid you enough and you worked hard enough, he could get the same amount of work done in 5 days as he did 6. But you didn't necessarily get your $5 a day because you were hired in. He said you were going to get it. You had to have a certain quality to you. They had a department Henry created called the Sociology Department. And they would actually come to your home, and they would look at your home, and they would see if you took on boarders. If you took on boarders, you were disqualified. If you drank, you were disqualified, okay, for that. They would teach your wife how the best to cook and to be more efficient in what you did. There were certain criteria that you had to have before you got that $5. And to tell you the God's truth, there was very few that got it.
Now, that's a part of that story that I have never heard. I have never heard that there were. I just thought he was a guy who said, you know what, I want my workers to be able to buy my product. So here's the $5 a day. You're going to do the hard work, but you're going to be able to. I had never heard that before.
You know, he's so credited for being the inventor of interchangeable parts, right? That's how the assembly line happened, was you had to have interchangeable parts. Otherwise, one person made every piece of a gun or one person made every piece of something. And with his invention of it sounds like humans were interchangeable parts to this guy. If I get a human that fits into these specifications, doesn't take boarders, so I know that he's not making extra money on the side, then he's going to qualify for me. It's just, literally saw people as another widget.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I agree.
And it's that whole patriarchal view. I mean, the same thing said about Milton Hershey in our area, where we're from in our area, that, you know, he created this town, but you had better be in line and you had better follow the path that he thought was best. And heaven forbid if you decided that we'd like a little bit more of the prophets. And, you know, this is the part about Hershey, because it's the same basic story as Ford. You know, they had sit down strikes and, you know, they fought for better wages, hours and conditions. And he met them with, you know, people with clubs and beat them in the streets.
Yes. It's interesting that you talked about the prophets. Henry didn't like to share those prophets.
Of course not.
he really didn't like doing it. He failed, if I remember correctly, twice. The third time he was in a partnership with the Dodge brothers. The Dodge brothers, they wanted, not only for themselves, but for the other stockholders, they wanted profits. They wanted to get some shareholder money back from them, if you will. I've lost a word here for that. But dividends. And so they, in fact, sued Henry Ford. And it was tied up in court a long time, but they eventually won. And it was in the millions that their settlement. And you got to remember the time here. We're talking in the teens. That was an astronomical amount of money. And it's really interesting. What really created all the fuss was Henry Ford wanted to build the Rouge plant. The deal with the Rouge plant is that raw materials came in, finished vehicles came out. So the Arnor ships, and I'm not certain they come across the Great Lake. They would come up the river there. I would assume it would be in the Rouge. And they would unload. They had a steel mill. They had a foundry, if I got that right. They had a glass plant. They had a stamping plant. And they had an assembly plant. And that plant is still there to this day.
Wow.
It's still there. But that was the fight. They didn't want to put money in. They thought Henry was crazy. So Henry had always vowed that he would never, ever, if he could do, go be have a partner again. And he wanted to buy the company. So when his son Edsel, he was 25 years old, and he put him in charge of everything, but he really wasn't. Henry was still in the sidelines running everything. So Henry hired a company, a banking firm, and he spread a rumor that I'm done. He said, I'm going to start my own motor company and in direct competition with Ford Motor Company. Well, the stockholders were terrified. So, like I said, he hired this investment firm, bank, if you will, went around to all of his investors and said, we're going to offer you so much money for your Ford stock. And these people putting two and two together, and they said, we're out of here. So Henry bought their stock back for pennies, which at the time, if I remember correctly, $125, $150 million. Like I said, Henry was one of the richest people, or the richest person in the United States. But he bought it out. He owned the company.
That's like Ivan Boesky on steroids. That's like making your own insider trading, and then trading on the inside, and then undoing the insider trading.
Beautiful.
Wow, he didn't go to jail for that.
No, there was nothing there.
No,
I mean,
there was
no laws that regulated any of that. I mean, again, you know, here I hate to keep coining that phrase, the robber baron, but they pretty much did what they want. You know, you got the Homestead Steel Act. Okay, he did what Rockefeller did in Colorado. You know, he burned up I don't know how many people in those tents on a strike out there. You know, they pretty much did what they want. And Henry Ford had the governor of Michigan on his side. You know, had the march up the street up there when times are bad during the Depression, and they end up killing five. They weren't strikers. They weren't struck. They looked at Henry Ford as a godsend to them, as someone who would save them from this god-awful Depression. And, it, you know, put me back to work, Henry Ford. There was no unemployment rate. There was no welfare. There was nothing like it back in those days. And they had a little march up. I can't remember the name of the street now. But the militia was waiting on them. Henry Ford had called the governor, and they brought the militia in, and they ended up killing five people.
I mean, as we're doing this tour, going across the country, We're finding these stories. We're talking to historians who, you know, you talked about Ludlow a minute ago, you know, in Colorado. Mm-hmm. All of these stories are there, but yet our kids don't learn them in history mm-hmm. classes. It's not part of the curriculum anymore. And I think it must be.
Yes, I think it does, too. I think it needs to be, you know, I think that I can't remember. You don't know where you're going if you don't know where you've been. It's one of those type of things, you know. I mean, a lot of people coin those phrases, but, you know, you stop and think about it, it's true.
Phil, did you have labor history when you were in school?
Good question.
Or did you have labor history at home?
No, not at home, and I don't recollect it in school, no.
So, you know, because one of the things I've been asking people as we've been on this tour is, you know, where did you get your union background? Where did you get the foundation? As a kid growing up, my grandfather was a Teamster for, you know, 30-odd years. I got it from him. You know, it was passed down through the generation. So I'm always curious of people who've spent their lives working in a union or, you know, you, the historian for the local here in Kansas City. How did you come to it?
Well, you know, when I graduated school, my first job, of course, were farm related, you know, and then I moved to the city, and there's every job that I've ever worked at was unionized. And, you know, it just, I saw the good things that they did. I got drafted during the Vietnam conflict, and when I was discharged, I came back to the job that I left from. And it was unionized, but things had kind of turned around, the economy then, and the plant wasn't working very much. So I was working 3 days a week, sometimes 2 days a week, you know, had a family, had a new home, new car, you know, a new baby. And so I needed to find a place. And I remember the railroad workers. I would be sitting on the dock at this small place I worked, and railroad workers come through. They made $40 a day. They made $5 an hour. And I thought, my Lord, what would I do with all that money? And I got, you know, I needed a job. So I went to unemployment office, and they gave me a choice of working for a steel mill, working for a GM plant, or working in Ford, Ford being the closest that comes to where I came to work. But when I came here, and the reason I came, I'm getting away from the reason, was because when the plant didn't work at no fault of your own, you were paid for it. In other words,
well, we've heard an awful lot about that.
You got
a
short
years.
Week benefit, and I'm going to tell you what, you know, if it's not your fault, you know, and they lay you off, you know, or they cut your hours, who really suffers there? You do. And if what it did was it forced Ford Motor Company to think smart about their job. Yep. It made them do their job so they wouldn't have to pay that short week benefit. You know, and it's funny that through the years, and I know a lot of these old timers that are here too can say that the union made Ford Motor Company a better company simply because we forced them, I shouldn't say force, contractually, they did a better job at running their own business. And in the later years, when, you know, before I retired, things turned around. They got to asking the employees, how was the best way to do this? And they would put us in charge of certain things, particularly with changeovers, and we would see a better thing. We'd see a vendor that wasn't our part maker, okay, like a door lock or hinge or a piece of sheet metal wasn't quite right. We would say, hey, these people are not doing their job right.
And that's something I want to take a quick break here, but when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about that because, you know, to me, that's an important message out of all of this that, you know, with workers having a say on the job not only helps them, but mostly helps the company. So we're going to take a quick break right back from the People's Tour for America here in Kansas City, UAW Local 249, the first Ford local in the country. Quick break right back from the road. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It goes back to the fundamentals, intoned a Wall Street analyst. The economy is improving. Improving for whom? By fundamentals, he means the high-flying stock market, booming corporate profits, and top executive pay. Those are signs of an economy that is top-heavy, not healthy. In fact, our economy is teetering dangerously because it's not sustained from below by a strong middle class. Economist Paul Krugman notes that far from improving, our economy remains in a low-grade depression. Of course, that thermometer zooms to a high grade if you're among the millions of Americans who are jobless, working for low wages, or able to get only part-time temporary employment. Yes, the unemployment rate has ticked down, but not because of any jump in job creation. Rather, the dismal lack of hiring has become so discouraging that many people simply give up the hunt, which magically removes them from the ranks of the unemployed. Most Congress critters clearly don't care about America's middle-class jobs depression. The White House cares, but doesn't treat it as the crisis it is, so nothing happens. The only jobs push we've had is the stopgap effort by the Federal Reserve to pump enough money into the economy to keep unemployment from worsening. But rather than push harder, Ben Bernanke, head of the central bank, recently sounded retreat. He, too, uses the faulty unemployment statistic as a crutch to claim improvement. The jobless rate, he says, could drop to 7% next year, so the Fed's stimulus will no longer be needed. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's shameful. Even if that was the true rate, 7% equals 11 million unemployed Americans and many millions more who would still be underemployed. From Bernanke to Congress, all government officials who shrug their shoulders and give up on helping that many Americans should themselves be made jobless.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.
Proud supporter of the union workers who fought, bled, and died for your weekend. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. The People's Tour for America here in Kansas City, Missouri. We're at the UAW Local 249, the very first Ford local in the country, established January 15th, 1937. We're sitting here with Phil Brown. He was a former recording secretary. He's the recording secretary for the retiree chapter of the local, former historian here at Local 249. Phil, thanks for sticking around for us.
Thank you.
You know, we were talking about, you know, the conditions of the past, you know, how things used to be, where the lines broke down. Out to the park you went. If you needed to get 15 hours in an eight-hour day, you got paid for 8 hours. You know, one of the things that I like to say that, you know, in my lifetime I've benefited from your generation and your parents' generation who organized and made conditions so much better. I want to go back and focus a little bit more on the actual working conditions before workers had a voice. What were things like in the plant for you when you started, or for the guys before you?
Well, for me personally, I know for a fact that, you know, you were on probation. You had a 90-day probation. And pretty much you had very little union help. If you did something wrong, you were subject to discharge because you were in that probationary period of time. Working conditions were hot. You know, I came from a farming community. And I know heat, you know, particularly stacking hay in an old barn. Yeah. You know, you could hear the clouds come over. You know, the tin would pop when it would cool down, and then heat back up again. But it was horrific. The fans were okay, you know, and we had a water fountain, but not as many as it was after I retired, or before I retired, rather.
So in your years, everything progressively got better.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they did. I mean, it got to the point where, you know, when I worked on the line, you had a water fountain that you could walk to if you would get up far enough, maybe a half a job up the line. You know, you could go get a drink of water and not worry about getting in the hole, so to speak. And when I first hired in, I mean, you were pretty much, the line had to stop. Something had to happen before you would have a chance to get a drink. And you never ask we had a one man per section that was called a hay boy. And, you know,
hey,
why?
Hey boy, go get this.
Yes, that's exactly it. And so, you know, you didn't ask a hay boy, hey, I need to get a drink. He'd look at you like, are you crazy? I don't got time for that. You know, he was mostly there for repair something. that would before it got out of your section, or that you know, someone had got hurt, had to go to first aid, or God forbid, you know, someone got extremely ill and he had to do their job or something like that, or a bathroom call.
But, you know, I thought you were going to say he had to help them. No, he had to do their job. You know, he didn't have to. So, did people drop? Like when you were at work, did people faint from? I mean, you get thirsty. It's bad.
Yeah. Yeah, it mostly happened with new hires. The new hires were just not acclimated to that vigorous type of work, and which is nonstop. I mean, you went in and you did the same thing, the same amount of time. You were time studied with 1/100th of a second in your process. You know, you had a little process sheet on each job location. This is what you were supposed to do, okay, for that particular job, and they time studied you. We had an engineer, that's all they did. They said with a stopwatch, and they knew each element, how long it took each element to do, and that's how you were done. And the new hires, they would get, you know, they would work so fast and so hard, and it's that old saying, work smarter, not harder. And but they didn't do that. They just worked harder, and they would get theirself worked up in a frenzy. And I don't know how many in my later years I was a utility man, a relief man, and I would see some guy or some woman having trouble, and I would help them and, you know, get them up out of the hole, and need to get a drink, go get a drink, you know.
Well, that is part of being a member of a union. I would think that's the culture that...
Absolutely.
Instead of, you know, well, you're behind, the heck with you. You keep falling behind until they get rid of you and someone else goes in there.
Yeah. You know, a lot of times you couldn't help, though, because you had a job to do,
right,
too. And so you saw people having trouble, and you did your best to help them. And I had a good friend that helped me on many occasions, you know, and I remember that. And that's how union brothers and sisters cling together, if you will. I know I maybe sound a little funny there, but we did. You know, majority of the people in there, with one had trouble, they all had trouble.
Well, I mean, you know, I was a Teamster for 20 years, and it's that same kind of brotherhood, that same kind of, mm-hmm, it's a family.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with that wholeheartedly. You know, we always tried to take one another. We know we had someone had a death in the family. Someone would get a card, and, you know, we'd pass around all day long into, yep, the section, put a couple of bucks in it. It didn't mean much, you know. It was a thought that counted, that, you know, you remembered them, and you felt sorry for them, the loss of their family.
Yeah, and
I think it meant a lot.
I think it meant an awful lot. And the sad reality is I think we're losing that as part of our culture.
I think so. I think you're right.
Now, the young people in the UAW is still 249, still here. How are the young union people? Are they, do they have that brotherhood and sisterhood?
You know, I've been retired for 10 years. A lot of things have changed over at our plant in those 10 years. Ford bought out a lot of the older people. They wanted to reduce wages, and they've been pretty effective doing that. They've effectively dropped the wages. Since I left and a new hire at that plant, wages have dropped in half.
In half?
In half. Okay.
How much of that is part of the when they had the bailout, GM and Chrysler, how much is part of the economic collapse during the Bush years? Is that a portion of it, or has this been concession after concession over a series of years?
I think it's been more of a concessionary. Probably the recession has affected it more so, because people are more apt to take those concessions when they see the... what's went on in the economic situation. You know, they're saying, if and we don't take these concessions, this is what may happen to us, okay? And so, yeah, those concessions, I think, are due to the economic, but mostly it was Ford wanted to reduce their responsibility as far as wages. You know, they not only got rid of part of the workforce at a lower wage, they also have the traditional retirement plan is no longer there. It's a 401k. For the retirees, we have a trust that is set up for our health care now, and that's something. Ford funded that with billions of dollars. And, you know, as they have sort of separated themselves away from those very costly aspects of the contract. And so they have made themselves a very lean organization now. You know, they're making money, which is good. It's good.
No, it's good for the workers. And, you know, the thing is you know, going forward, you know, you want to try and get some of those benefits back. Because you look back to this 1934 sit-down strike, one of the reasons we came here to talk. As things got better progressively, the next generation did better. And the sad reality is, you know, I look at, you know, my grandparents' generation who could look to their kids and go, you know what, things are going to get better for you. You know, I look at my children and I wonder, are they?
I agree. It seems like we're going backwards. You know, our first retirement was 1949, I believe, that contract. And I believe it was like $50 a month. It could have been $100. I can't remember exactly now. And from there, we went on traditional. I have a traditional retirement plan with Ford. That's what I have. And but the young people that are in their new hires in now, I shouldn't say young people because some of them aren't young, and they don't have a traditional retirement plan. And they depend on a 401k, which is usually tied into the stock market, you know. And so we all know what happened to the stock market in November 9th of 2008.
Yeah.
And so that was not so good.
Yeah, my sister is a teacher. So, of course, they had teachers union. And she lost half her retirement.
That's mine, 200.5.
Yeah.
It's not a 401k, it's a 200.5.
Yeah.
Because half of it was gone.
Yes, it just disappears in thin air. You know, I always say that, I don't know, maybe this is the improper time to say it, but that's one thing George Bush didn't get done, privatized Social Security. You know, it was a good thing because I don't know that anyone foresaw what happened in 2008.
I think most people foresaw it.
If he had privatized Social Security, it would have been wiped out. Now, that's another thing. Labor unions have been so instrumental in politics, and a lot of people curse labor unions for that. But all the people that labor unions supported, certainly the president, and now are all of a sudden talking about things like cutting Social Security. What's happened?
Well, you got me. I really don't know. You know, you're cutting stuff that really doesn't need to be touched. I mean, I've heard the saying, we've paid into that. It's our money. Well, what are you doing messing with it? You know? And so I feel the same way. You know, I paid in until the later years the maximum in Social Security. And I did it for a few years until it got so high. Of course, I never made six figures, and so it got over way over.
You paid on every penny of it.
Yeah, and so I paid in my money, and, you know, leave it alone, guys. It belongs to me. And the Medicare, or what's odd here, I may be getting off subject a little bit, is that you know, I see very few of the other political party turning down their Social Security check or Medicare, which in fact in 1937, I believe it was, that the Social Security Act was passed. There were no Republicans that even signed the bill. It was all, you know, none of them voted for it. 1966, Medicare. How many Republicans voted for that? Three. But odd that it is, if you see a Republican that's retired, do they turn around and give that check back, or do they keep it?
Yeah.
They love that check. They love those benefits.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Phil Brown. He is the recording secretary for the retiree chapter of Local 249 here in Kansas City of the UAW. Also a former historian. I'd like to go back a minute because, you know, at the beginning of this, we talked about workers having a voice on the job. And it's one of the key tenets that I think that unions bring to the table that, you know, when I was driving a truck for a living, if I went out and I saw the brakes were out of alignment, I said, I'm not taking it because it's unsafe, not for me, not just for me, but for everybody around me. And it's bad for the company. Because if I get into a wreck, somebody's paying that. And I think that's one of the things that's missing in the discussion about why labor is so important to this country. And the same thing I think happened at Ford.
Yes, it did. In the early 90s, that would have been about 93, Ford instituted a a new program that it took, you signed a bid for it, and you became a product specialist. I was one of those product specialists. And a lot of other my friends were. Of course, it was by seniority. That's how you got the job. And when you had a changeover, we actually built certain of those new vehicles that went down the line sporadically. You would build one, you would send it down the line, and then most everyone was laid off. And so, you know, you would build that, and then as you got better at it, you added more people. But more people were recalled back, and then the line speed would pick up and pick up. But what we did was we would look at problems that we were having in assembly. If a vendor, a parts maker, would have something that didn't fit quite right or didn't work, quality wasn't quite right, we would speak up, we would have meetings every day, and we would say, this is not right. We would get, the vendor would be called in if he wasn't already on site, and we would go over that. We have a schematic of the part and say, this part here, this needs to be redone. And so, in fact, is we did get a voice in the production of it. That went well. You know, it came to the point where they initiated, they called it a stop button program. And each job had a button that you could turn off the line. If something wasn't right on your job or something came to you that made it so you couldn't do your job, then you could turn that line off. And I know we talked earlier about the cost of shutting a line off per minute. And so you understand what it was costing them to initiate that. It was abused, obviously, is like anything like that. But, you know, I had a lot of toe-to-toes with supervisors who, what I would turn the line off, I couldn't do the job. I mean, there's something wrong. We need to fix this right here, you know.
That's a huge leap forward from the line is going and you can't even leave to go to the bathroom
Right.
do anything, to where now you're empowered to say something's not right, I'm going to fix it. And, you know, that's not the message we hear from in the mainstream media, which is, well, it's just turning lug nuts. And, you know, it's the workers' fault for things breaking down and not being right. So, I mean, it's a very, very interesting.
It worked well, too. I mean, we had the product specialists that were there. You know, after we launched the vehicle, we continued on. We worked right there, and we were responsible for so many men. And we would fix it. People would see, and the people were really good. The workers, they would come up to you, or they would holler at you and said, hey, this part here is not right. And we would do our best to fix it before it got off the station or out of that section. And, you know, supervisors, they started removing supervisors. I remember at one time somebody saying there was a supervisor for every 10 men. And when I left, there was a supervisor for approximately 30 to 40 people. And so we were practically running the plant.
You should be.
Yeah, we were actually running the plant, you know, and, you know, they'd have a problem. Most supervisors were like deer in headlights. I mean, you know, they'd have, what's going on, you know. And so we would have to tell them, we would fix them, you know, up to a point. I mean, obviously, you know, we were not management. We could not make those decisions as such. But we actually told them a lot of things that needed to be done in order to make, not so much to make the vehicle better, but to make it so it would go out the end of the line in the best that we could build.
You know, when I look at that, when I hear you talk and I look at your expressions, you know, there's a real sense of pride in the work that you've done. And, you know, when you hear people talk about auto workers and you hear workers in general, it's just a job. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't take stake in the company. And in having this time with you, you know, I can see that you were proud of working for Ford. You were proud of the work that you did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was. And, you know, I have to throw this in. I was proud that I was union also, because union gave me the ability to do that. Okay? Without that, we would have been back the same way as this picture on the wall. Nothing would have changed. But without that union right there, without guaranteeing me that 40-hour or short week benefit, okay, and it made, you know, a grievance procedure when you did have problem, when you were, let's say, discharged wrongly, or something happened, you know, like you did something terribly on the line that resulted in a great loss of time, they could discipline you. But if, you know, we had a grievance procedure where a committeeman would represent you in labor relations and say, hey, this guy couldn't do his job because this job came to him wrong, or it was not done correctly, so he couldn't do his job or correctly. And so, you know, it was a tough place to work, but it was hot, it was dirty, you know, and you still had those toe to toes with supervisors, but you know, it kind of broke the monotony, you know. And it was a lot of fun. I mean, I have a close friend that we did a lot of that, and you know, you had good supervisors that were smart, that were intelligent. And they were, you didn't have to deal with them that way. But then you had on the other end, you had them, one of them were the box of rocks.
Yeah.
And you just couldn't tell them anything. It was their way or the highway, you know. And so there you went. You had just an ongoing war with them. But we had ways, people on the line were dealing with supervisors like that. And most of the time, they didn't last very long.
You know, and last question I've got for you. When we came into your facility here, which is a beautiful facility here in Kansas City, UAW Local 249. I noticed a sign that said no foreign cars allowed on the property.
Yes. That's been there for a long time. And
as it should be.
As it should be. You know, it. I hear a lot of feedback from people who say that, I have a Toyota that was built in California, and, you know, it's built by union labor. And I said, yeah, it's true. I know that. But I said, you know, the monies that they make, they contribute nothing back to this country and the infrastructure. 10 cents every dollar is the only thing that stays. That 90 cents goes back to the motherland. And even though we are union workers, a lot of times, in particular, that Toyota plant in California, they closed up shop. And they told their workers, bye, see you sometime. Okay? Those people have a job. And that's what I see a problem with a foreign automaker in this country. You know, we're using, I'm not going to say majority, and there's a small percentage of them that use union labor. Most of them are all south in the Sun Belt.
Right.
And they don't. And those people down there, you'd be surprised, they want to unionize.
Oh, absolutely.
They want to unionize because they see the benefit of being unionized.
Is it going to take this again, 1934? Is it going to take that to get them organized? I look at the broken structure of our labor laws. Is that what it's going to take again?
I think you're right. I think it's going to. We're going to have to do like they did when they organized Ford. They can't take a small place like Kansas City. They're going to have to go to the heart, which was the River Rouge plant at Dearborn. And they're going to strike that plant, which is a large plant. And you got to, I hate to say this word, but you got to hurt them in the pocketbook. If you don't hurt them there, you know, they're not going to pay any attention to you. You can sit head to head and you can talk to labor can, to management, and unless you put a little pressure on them, they're not going to change.
I'm right there with you. Phil, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us, and thank you for bringing us into your union hall.
Thank you.
Phil Brown, the recording secretary for the retiree chapter here at Local 249 UAW. Quick break, right back from the road. The People's Tour for America. You can find where we've been, where we're going, peoplestourforamerica.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
Proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to Win Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Laura Reyes, Secretary Treasurer of AFSCME, says the immigration bill passed by the Senate doesn't offer enough protections to U.S. workers and skilled worker visa programs.
The visa program for the higher skilled workers does not have sufficient protection for U.S. workers to ensure that they have the first shot at getting hired and that employers don't use the program to bring down wages. We also believe that the Senate bill unjustifiably and unnecessarily requires that an additional $30 to $40 billion be spent on border security on the southern border, on top of the ramp that border security the Obama administration has already deployed, and that the Senate bill had already increased with more border security agents, drones, and fencing. But we have to get this done, and right now offers the best opportunity in decades to be on the right side of history.
Reyes is the first woman Secretary Treasurer of AFSCME and says she's excited to be able to fight for justice for workers as AFSCME fights back against attacks on public worker rights. She says one important issue for her is equal pay for women.
Women still earn less for doing the same work than their male co-workers do, and Congress has a chance to further close the gap by passing the Paycheck Fairness Act. And AFSCME strongly supports this legislation. So this is an exciting time for me to come in and to lead the fight in solidarity and to make sure that we stand up for workers in this country, that we stand up for women and social and economic justice.
Federally contracted low-wage workers are on the move again in Washington, D.C. They plan a strike, protests, and civil disobedience at the Ronald Reagan Building and the old post office pavilion. It's a protest against wage theft as the workers call on President Obama to guarantee a living wage and a voice on the job for federally contracted workers. 2 million workers, many of them low-wage, work for the federal government through private contractors. Oakland, California city employees and BART system workers both launched separate strikes on Monday to bring attention to pay and security concerns. Jesse Russell reports.
Public transit in the Bay Area nearly ground to a halt on Monday as workers called a strike against the Bay Area Transit Authority. In addition to the transit strike, thousands of Oakland city employees walked off the job over their own stalled contract negotiations. The city workers made substantial concessions to the city during the economic downturn, and the workers have accused Oakland Mayor Gene Kwan of not joining in negotiations. So even though she offered a cost of living increase this weekend, they still decided to strike. SEIU Local 1021 Oakland Chapter President Dwight McElroy told the crowd that the strike was about more than negotiations.
The individuals who are hired at the city of Oakland who have no work rights, who have no health care, who have no benefits. Somebody got to start speaking up and say, you cannot continue to mistreat these individuals.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. If you've missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. The People's Tour for America here in Kansas City, Missouri. We're at UAW Local 249, United Auto Workers. The very first Ford local in the country established January 15th of 1937. I'm sitting here with Dick Drennan. He is the chairperson of the retiree chapter of the local here. Dick, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome.
You know, you're sitting in front of a picture of the 1934 sit-down strike here in Kansas City, a big moment in history. And, you know, you look at the faces of these people, the stories that I'm sure each one of them have. You know, was some of that stuff passed down to you in your years? I understand you started in 1959, so it's well after this. But I got to imagine some of those stories were passed down, if not anecdotally, you know, maybe directly.
Yeah, I was told many stories. A lot of them I don't remember, but the one that really sticks in my mind was they had a park across the street from the Winchester plant, and they would be a crowd out in the park and waiting for a job, and during the day they would kick them out the front door and hire them into the back door, and that went on pretty much all the time. And it was just a terrible place to try to do your job. You know, a lot of the stories I know from 59, we went to work there, we were getting 3 minutes an hour relief.
Jeez.
And it's given to you twice a day.
What can you do in 3 minutes?
Well, they give it to you at two different. They give it to you like 4 hours. You get, you know, 12 minutes or whatever, and different time. You go to the restroom, get back. And at that time, there was no one extra on the line to let you go to the restroom. They had to try some way to get the relief man to do it.
So if you couldn't get the relief man to come and do it, what'd you do?
Just go walk off. You had to, you know, it was difficult to get a drink of water, and it was just hot. You know, when it was 80 degrees of a morning when you went to work, you didn't want to go to work because it was going to be 100 degrees in the plant. You could just almost bet on that. And if you were first on relief, you got your relief. You didn't pick up your tools. You just took your relief first, and you had to go till lunchtime before you get another relief. And it's a pretty long time. And if it's just difficult to get somebody to let you go to the restroom and go get a drink, well, they wouldn't let you go get a drink of water. You had to work up the line far enough, if you could, to go get your drink of water and really rush to do it. But you know, it was just the union has helped so much on things like that, and on our wages and our benefits. We went to work, we was paying half our insurance, had no dental plan and no eyeglass plan, and you know, we were just I'd say paying half of our insurance. And I went to work for $2.18 an hour in 59, and I was glad to get that because I've been making $1.44 an hour. And I was a old farm boy, and that's what they hired. They wanted somebody to work. And for a long time, when I would come in, they'd say, well, you go do this job. And it just, you were stiff and sore all the time because it seemed like every night you had a different job to do.
And this is hard. This is hard physical labor.
It's hard physical labor, and especially if you, you know, if he's on a new job, you know, they ordinarily will allow you 3 days to learn a job. But in my case, I did a different job almost every night and wasn't smart enough to realize that, that was a utility job for a while, but you know, it's just difficult.
So, you know, in your experience in the years that you work, what would happen? Because since this is a hard physical manual labor job, what would happen if someone got injured? What would happen if one of your coworkers or you got injured now? And then if you could, you know, maybe look back to, you know, these guys here in this picture back in 1934, what happened to them?
Well, you know, we didn't really get injured. We were just, most of us were pretty tough when we went to work there, and I just don't remember what they did do because they didn't really have any extra people. If they had extra people when the shift started, they'd send them home, so they would find somebody somewhere, and a lot of times they'd put two people on a job if they had to. They didn't like doing that, but
because the reason I ask is, you know, you had said, you know, back when this picture was taken, there was a park across from the plant where, you know, people would gather and wait for somebody to be fired or basically pushed out the door so that, you know, basically next. So I'm curious if that was a part of it, if someone got injured, and I don't know, that's why I'm asking.
We never had that problem, really.
When did the park end? When did that
was when the plant was over on Winchester. I don't know exactly where the park was. I'm not familiar with the plant over there. Don't know exactly where it was, but that's the way they said they did it. So
now, when you went home and you were sore every day, you had a wife and family, did you?
Oh yes, I had wife and two girls. So.
And you got to just lay down and do nothing. You didn't have to take the kids to the park or go to their class plays, or you didn't have to do anything in your real life, right?
Well, we didn't do too much because we just didn't really feel like it, you know. But like you was talking to Phil, he and I both still do a little farming, and we still stay active, and you know, it makes you tough.
Those wives that were all you know, Phil spoke about the Ford company telling wives how to be more efficient. I mean, if you didn't have somebody at home running your family, your family would fall apart because you guys were always at work, right?
Well, we were always at work, but in my case, my wife worked too, and we had a babysitter, and I worked nights most of the time. She worked days, and I would try to take care of the kids until I could take them. Well, my mother babysat for us, and until I could take them over there, she'd get up and go to work, and I'd get up about that time and try to take care of them until I could get them to the babysitters. But it was a chore.
You know, and these are the families, and these are the people who have jobs, and thankfully to a union they had a job that paid well enough so that they could afford a babysitter. You know, I worked in a homeless shelter for years, and people would get jobs, but there was nobody to watch the kids because they were making $7.25 an hour, which was $4.50 after that was over, and the babysitters were almost that much.
Yeah, you're correct, and it was you know, it was difficult for us back in '59 in the early '60s. It was difficult for us to make enough money to where we could really enjoy anything. We finally got to where we enjoyed camping and boating, and we finally got to where we could do that about twice a month. And that's about the only way that we survived and didn't be bothered mentally, really. You know, we got out where we could do a few things, but it was difficult. You know, I have active people say, well, you know, how come you didn't save any money back, you know, when you went to work? Well, there were so many times that, you know, we either worked 58 hours or we worked every other week. It was never 40 hours a week, and it was never that. And then about the time we get going good, we'd be on strike. And it was just difficult for us.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Richard Drennan. He is the chairperson of the retiree chapter of the UAW. Local 249 here in Kansas City as the People's Tour for America here in Kansas City, Missouri. You know, in looking at the current state of the union, you look at as the chairperson of the retiree chapter. We had talked a little bit about the next generation, the younger folks. Do you think that there's been a loss of people identifying with the union? Because we hear a lot of messaging in the media saying, well, you know, the 1934, that was way back then. You know, conditions were horrible back then. You know, things are so much better today. We don't need those things. Do you think that's gone, that messaging has worked for the next generation?
Well, I don't mean to bash the young people. I think the world and all of them. But they need to take more interest in their union. They just don't seem to really take the interest that they used to take. I can't even imagine what would happen if they'd have a 5-week strike today. I don't know whether they could find enough people to walk the picket line or not. We have several people that are in the union that enjoy the union and really take a great part in the union. But these people, active people, need to find more time for their union rather than boating and camping, and they need to find time to go to their union meeting.
Because you did it. You went boating and camping and all
well,
that.
I did.
You still found time.
I did, and I really didn't take that much part in the union when I was there, but I take a part in it now as much as I can. And I see where I probably should have taken more part, but if it come time for a strike, I guarantee you I'd be there walking the picket line. And but I'd love to see them take more interest in their union.
I remember when I started, you know, I had an old timer, you know, take me aside, you know, young buck, come on over here. I'm going to show you the way. And one of the very first pieces of advice this guy gave me, he says, you put 6 months of pay in the bank. You don't ever touch that.
Right.
For if you do have to go on strike for 5 or 6 weeks, or if you have to do some of these things, that you have that cushion, that you're not at their mercy. And that was probably the best piece of advice I ever got from one of the old-timers.
Yeah, I had union people tell me when I was younger, get a couple months' money ahead, and said we can get a lot more in our union if you would do that and be able to, you know, go through a strike without begging to come back to work, you know.
In looking at the next generation, because, you know, it has that been broken where the old-timer takes the young guy aside and that mentoring that I benefited from, and I know so many others did, has there been that generational break, do you think?
Well, I don't know what really I think happened. Ford Motor Company bought a lot of people out, and those were good union people. And I think that hurt our union by the buyouts. I think it hurt badly because they got rid of a lot of good union people, and so many of them now, if you would ask them if they take a buyout again, no way. They would say, no way would we take the buyout. I phone bank a lot, and Phil does too. And I quit here and phone banked here during the election, and we had some young people in here phone banking, and I talked to them a lot, and they said, why do you keep coming back and working with the union? I said, well, I realize what I've got and where it come from. And he said, well, I'm just amazed that you older people come in here and work with the union like you do. And they were having a difficult time trying to get people to come in, phone bank, active people. I have no problem that way with our older people. If you want phone bankers, all you got to do is give them paper to write on, to put your name down, and I'll be there. But they had such a hard time trying to get young people to come in, phone bank.
You know, I think that's why the military is made out of the young, though. They don't see consequence. You would not get a whole pile of 70-year-old people to join the military and go to war. They know better. Like, there's got to be another way around this, boys, rather than me getting shot. I think there's got to be a better answer. Yeah. You know, and I think the other thing that we've noticed is, and I'm the only one who can say this because I'm not in a labor union, although Lord knows I wish I were. They'd be lucky to strike because right now we're going around this country and talking to people that are locked out of work. And before that happens to you, think about the power you need to take in your workplace, because workers are getting locked out now by these huge multinational corporations. They don't give a rat's anything whether or not you starve to death or you lose your car or you lose your house. They don't care. And locking workers out like they did in Oregon and Washington State, that's just a crime.
Well, you know, we have a $2 checkoff retirees on our union dues, and that's voluntary. You don't have to do it. And we just come back from summer school. We got a award 90% of our retirees pay that $2.
Nice.
Yeah. It's either 90 or over, you know.
What's the $2 for?
It's a retirees checkoff for union dues. They pay $2. It's voluntary. You don't have to do it. But 90% of our retirees still paying that $2.
And that's the help. That's for political action.
Well, it's not only political action. It's what goes on at our retirees chapter. That takes care. We use no active retiree money on our chapter. And
that's fantastic. 90%, over 90%.
Yeah, over 90%.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
Let me ask you the last question I've got for you. In looking back over your years, you know, because I talk to a lot of people that say, you know, the best thing that ever happened to me is I got a union job because then I could afford to make a decent living and I have a decent retirement. And looking back over your years, what would you tell a young guy, you know, coming on the first day? What's the message you would want them to know?
I'd want them to know to be tough, you know, and be proud that you're a union member, and just hang in there. It probably doesn't get any easier until you retire, but after 30 years, you'll be able to retire and be able to enjoy the rest of your life.
At least we hope, if everything's not a 401k by then, and they don't collapse the economy again.
If you don't spend too much of your 401k, you'll be okay. But no, it's a long, hard life, but it's rewardable. It's something that you know, that's doable, and just be tough and hang in there. That's about all I ever say. And the union has been great for me, and it'll be great for you. So just hang in there.
Richard, I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Richard Drennan, chairperson of the retiree chapter of Local 249 here in Kansas City. Quick break from the road. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It goes back to the fundamentals, intoned a Wall Street analyst. The economy is improving. Improving for whom? By fundamentals, he means the high-flying stock market, booming corporate profits, and top executive pay. Those are signs of an economy that is top-heavy, not healthy. In fact, our economy is teetering dangerously because it's not sustained from below by a strong middle class. Economist Paul Krugman notes that far from improving, our economy remains in a low-grade depression. Of course, that thermometer zooms to a high grade if you're among the millions of Americans who are jobless, working for low wages, or able to get only part-time temporary employment. Yes, the unemployment rate has ticked down, but not because of any jump in job creation. Rather, the dismal lack of hiring has become so discouraging that many people simply give up the hunt, which magically removes them from the ranks of the unemployed. Most Congress critters clearly don't care about America's middle-class jobs depression. The White House cares, but doesn't treat it as the crisis it is, so nothing happens. The only jobs push we've had is the stopgap effort by the Federal Reserve to pump enough money into the economy to keep unemployment from worsening. But rather than push harder, Ben Bernanke, head of the central bank, recently sounded retreat. He, too, uses the faulty unemployment statistic as a crutch to claim improvement. The jobless rate, he says, could drop to 7% next year, so the Fed stimulus will no longer be needed. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's shameful. Even if that was the true rate, 7% equals 11 million unemployed Americans and many millions more who would still be underemployed. From Bernanke to Congress, all government officials who shrug their shoulders and give up on helping that many Americans should themselves be made.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference.
Garment production. At one point, the Kansas City garment industry in its heyday in the 40s and 50s was, in coats and suits, the second largest garment district in the country.
Yeah, because, you know, people think of New York. They don't think of Kansas City.
Right. And Kansas City is its own particular evolution, kind of in competition with New York and Chicago. But it was known for men's work clothes. Lee Jeans was and Lee Work Clothes were headquartered here in Kansas City, and they produced a tremendous amount of overalls and work apparel. It was also known for coats and suits, and it distributed largely in the Midwest and South. The products that were made here. I could tell you more about that if you want. And it produced dresses. The largest dress company in the world in the 1940s and 50s was the Nell Donnelly Dress Company, Nellie Don, it was called. And that's a whole story in itself. Nell Donnelly was vehemently anti-union and managed to keep the union out for a long time with the company union. And then they produced a lot of children's clothing here too.
So were there, and what were the workers? Were they, now we saw, I think, some of these coveralls on the men in the photograph in 1937 at the Ford plant, right? So who were the workers? Were they the wives and children of the people who worked at the Ford plant, say?
The workers were men and women, but largely women. I think about 90% of the employees were women. And, a lot of women, working class women were able to find, once they unionized, were able to find jobs that paid them a living wage. There were a lot of immigrants who worked in the factories. It became a source of employment for African Americans starting in about the 50s. And it was, I know a woman, I interviewed a woman once who came to Kansas City from a small town in Missouri to work in the bomber plant in Fairfax during World War II. And, you know, she said it was a great life. She made more money than she ever dreamed of. And they, you know, they partied and everything like that. And after the war was over, she lost her job. She became a garment worker and worked the rest of her life in the garment factories.
So they didn't make a lot of the clothing for the war?
They did make clothing for the war. They converted to do that. They made uniforms and all of that kind of stuff, yes.
But that particular woman got a much better job, higher paying job, in a bomber plant.
Now, what time, what year would the garment districts have started to evolve here?
It started in the 1890s. It really started to grow rapidly during World War I. Nell Donnelly Dress Company was founded in 1916, and the industry continued to grow until the 30s. And then it was a disaster. The conditions, which had improved to some extent, even though there was no unionization, really took a plunge. I mean, wages were cut from like $13 a week for a long-term employee down to $5 or $6, and in some plants, the Women's Trade Union League investigated. They found women were making $2 to $3 a week.
They cut their wages. Wages went down. That's what we see now.
Yeah, that's what we see now. But it was much more dramatic in the Great Depression. There were lots of layoffs. A lot of businesses shut down. And the workers that survived were told they were should be thankful to have jobs and accept these, much diminished wages. And so the International Ladies Garment Workers Union in 1935 called Kansas City the plague spot of the union. It was largely non-union, and it was desperately in need of organizing. There had been a lot of ILGWU strikes and union organizing activities in 1934 and 35 in Chicago and in St. Louis and in other places that had garment sectors, but Kansas City produced a lot, and it was largely non-union. And so actually starting in 34, the union began to send in organizers here. They sent in a guy named Abraham Plotkin, in 1934, and he began organizing workers in these very places. One of the big targets was the coat and suit industry, because it was kind of, they were more skilled and it was a higher dollar, and they decided that would be a good target to start with. And main company, one of the main companies was Kerrison, another was Brand and Puritz, and they began organizing their workers, and the bosses immediately began organizing against them, and they formed a negotiating committee of bosses,
So the bosses unionized?
Yeah, the bosses unionized. Bosses always unionize first. You know, we call it the Chamber of Commerce. In this case, they had a garment employers association. And this was under pressure of the National Industrial Recovery Act, which was passed in 1933, which set standards for various industries. And the standards for the garment industry, which were they attempted to enforce all over the country, were a 35-hour work week. That way they would spread jobs around, and $13 a week. And they tried to get the bosses to agree to these codes. And the union was all for it. That was the union's demand, that they apply the code. But instead, while some of the companies caved in, many of the companies refused to do that. And so there was a series of strikes that went on from 34 to 37 here, until the coat and suit industry was largely organized. I read the correspondence of Plotkin to David Jubinsky, who was the president of the ILGWU, his reports. And in one strike in 1934, almost like a month after he came here, there was a strike of people at a place called Kerrison. And what Mr. Kerrison tried to do was get workers from one of the other companies, Brand and Puritz, to scab. And he particularly tried to pit some of the black workers who were pressers against the workers who were on strike. And Plotkin said, tell all of America that young women and men and Negroes, I think he used that word. I don't remember what word he used exactly. Are unified on the picket line here in Kansas City. Kept pleading for money. People were so poor. People who weren't even on strike would come to the union and ask for food. And his reports are full of people who are hungry, and trying to hold on to jobs or unemployed.
Now, somebody in Pennsylvania who was on the cutting edge of abolitionism might not understand what it meant for blacks and white youth to band together. But you were saying this was a very racist area, at least at one time.
Well, this is Missouri, you know. I mean, Missouri didn't join the Confederacy, but it was a slave state. And Kansas City is a high, and to this day is a very segregated city in many ways in terms of living. You know, everything else is integrated now, but schools were segregated and virtually everything else. And so there was tremendous job discrimination against African Americans. And they got the lowest jobs. And they, you know, were considered not appropriate for unionization. The craft unions were completely segregated in the 1930s. It was only in World War II that they began to even consider the idea of having black locals, for instance, in the Carpenters Union. Before that, they were excluded.
Well, it wasn't until World War II that they integrated the military.
Well, it was after World War II, actually, that they integrated the military. And many unions in this city weren't fully integrated until the 1970s. The Musicians Union, Kansas City's famous for its jazz heritage, and there was Local 627 of the Musicians Union was the African American union. That's where Charlie Parker came out of, and Count Basie, and all these folks. If you go today to the Mutual Musicians Association, it used to be the union hall, and there's pictures of all the famous jazz greats from the 30s and 40s who were members of that union. That union was merged with the white union, which represented the symphony orchestra and folks like that, and not until the early 1970s.
Wow, and that is a story that also does, well, the union story doesn't get told, but that whole merging of women and men and people of color and white people happened, many people might say late, but it really happened peacefully within the union organization.
It happened peacefully, but there was fallout. For instance, the guys in the old-timers in Local 627 would tell you that they lost control of their union. You know, they were a minority, and they joined the white union and became part of the white union. And they no longer controlled it.
Yeah, so there was a payoff.
Yeah, there was a downside to it, too. And, you know, we had a vibrant African-American community with lots of small businesses, many of which went kaput after integration took hold, you know. So there was a downside to it as well.
So to do a Rick Smith's question, can you tell us what a day was like for a garment worker, say, in 1930?
a day for a garment worker would have been highly pressured and long. Main thing that I found out about, because this is what people left records about, was how low the wages were and how insecure the jobs were and how easy it was to be fired. So I can't really speak to a day in the life of the garment worker, except to say that the Kansas City industry was really interesting. Starting in the 1920s, the way they competed with the more highly skilled, experienced workers of the East was they introduced the assembly line. And they called it the section system, which was not the norm in garment factories in Chicago or New York. And so they divided up the labor.
So one woman might put the sleeves on, another one...
Exactly. Somebody else might put the collar on, and that's all you do all day. That allowed them to hire less skilled workers and pay them less. And also have new tools to pressure them to produce more and more. They all worked on piece rate system, and the piece rate, when the union came in, of course, negotiation of the piece rate was a huge issue, and, you know, and the renegotiation of the piece rate and so on and so forth.
When did these garment factories leave? They aren't here now.
They're not here now, and what you're seeing is now an entertainment district mixed with mixed-use buildings, a lot of lofts, and some, you know, like offices, that kind of thing. The buildings are very well kept up. Many of them have historical markers on them. And it's an area that could boom again, but it not as industry. The industry began to, the heyday of the industry was the 40s and 50s. It was already in decline by the 1960s. I have actually a copy of the last contract, which was negotiated in 1989 for one of the holdout companies, Rice Coat Company, but it was largely gone by then. And, you know, at the time there was a lot of blaming of the union, but in fact I did some interviews with retired owners, and nobody said it was the union. It was the global economy. It was the change in marketing. It was JCPenney. It was Kmart. It was the mass production that they required, that Kansas City simply couldn't meet the volume of orders that these new big stores were demanding. The Kansas City market sold all over the Midwest and South. They had salespeople going to small towns, selling to specialty dress women's stores. And so that's at least as far as the ladies' clothing and the children's clothing was concerned. And so when L.A. went into production, when they began moving garment manufacturing to the Southwest, and then overseas, which is already happening in the 1970s, they simply could not restructure fast enough to be able to meet that the kinds of demands that the retailers were really creating.
You make a good point. I think anyone, I'm 52, anyone my age and older can remember when there were eight store chains and 12 store chains, but smaller chains of these clothing stores that then got bought out and bought out and bought out, and even Macy's and Gimbel's, right? Gimbel's is gone. So that this one huge company ended up, and they must have had an enormous need for clothing to supply an entire chain that would cover the entire country.
Right. I think that's right. It's monopoly in retailing, which really affects a smaller garment district like this. And it was the pressure to drive down wages. And so they could get lower wages in non-union areas of the Sun Belt that they weren't able to get here.
And now with what happened just a few months ago in Bangladesh, 1,127 people dying in a factory collapse, was that something that we could have seen happen? Well, we had the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, but is that something that would have happened here more if it hadn't been for the unions?
Absolutely. I mean, we don't have any major disasters like that here in Kansas City. But as I said, the conditions in these factories were not good. They were the Women's Trade Union League called them sweatshops before the union came in. And the union was really very, very good in making a huge difference in terms of the wages and working conditions of these people. The union also had a reputation here, the ILG had a reputation here for really involving their members in the life of the union. The ILG all over the country, you know, had clinics and retirement homes. Here, they put on a lot of classes, and they had a lot of activities for children in order to serve the broader needs of their members as workers and as people. And they were really famous for that here.
Back where we live, back in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, there's a antique shop, and it's in an old factory. And what happened was a man in the Carlisle area had seen that women weren't sewing their own clothes, and he brought 10 women into a room, and they started making shirts. They made shirts and they made skirts, and he realized he was making a fortune on these shirts and skirts that people didn't have time to make anymore. Ended up being a big factory and a big business in Carlisle that went the way of the factories you're talking about. Is there ever going to be a time when someone can say, hey, I think I'll do this on my corner and just sell to my local community? Will that ever happen again, do you think?
Not unless we seriously change all of the subsidies and legal protection we give to large corporations. These big corporations weren't just a natural evolution of capitalism, although capital tends to concentrate wealth. They also had an awful lot of help from our government in terms of its trade policy and in terms of who gets subsidies, who gets tax preferences, and who doesn't. And small business today, it is truly an endangered species. And if you look at the number of bankruptcies of small businesses, every decade they go up and up and up. One thing that just slays me is everybody's being in love with entrepreneurialism. I mean, maybe entrepreneurialism worked in the 1820s, but it's becoming increasingly difficult for small business to survive in America. So unless we have some major, major changes in who runs this country, I don't see that kind of local market system coming back in here.
Now, my last question for you is, if you had a pulpit and a podium, and you could teach the average person who right now is working two jobs, who is hoping they can get to the kids' soccer game, knows they're making Kraft dinner one more time because that's all they could afford, if you could get one piece of information into that person's head about labor history and about the history of the working class in the United States, what would it be?
Workers only have power when they band together and practice solidarity.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Can I add one story that you might want to put in? Okay. There was this really neat story that occurs. In 1936, here in Kansas City, the city had just finished building the Municipal Auditorium, which was this grand palace for events. And the ILG was in the midst of a big strike against a company called Stern, Slegman & Prince, which was a big coat and suit manufacturer. And they had put together a show. Some people may know of Pins and Needles, which was a Broadway show that was a huge hit in the 1930s that the ILGWU helped write and sponsor, and then workers actually acted on Broadway and sang and danced and all that stuff. Well, they did a show in St. Louis. They put it together, and it had a cast of like 100 people. And it was the same kind of thing. It was stories from work and songs and stuff like that. So they decided to bring the whole cast to Kansas City to put it on to give support to the strike. And at the last minute, like the week of the event, the city told them that they would not be able to use the Municipal Auditorium, even though they had booked it. It was opening night there. They had just built it. And they were told that they couldn't use it because the manufacturers, the owners, had gotten to the city manager, this guy named Hugh McElroy. And he was part of the Pendergast machine. And so this organizer named Wave Tobin went to see Mr. McElroy. And I got this from a report she wrote to Dubinsky. And she said, I told him all about the working conditions and the terrible wages and the families that are going without and all and the brutality of the police on the picket line. And finally, I convinced him to let us use the auditorium. And, and she said, I think it was because his name's McElroy and my name's Tobin. You know, the solidarity of the Irish. And he relented and let them use it. And they passed out tickets to the show to the cops who were on the picket line and to many of the city fathers, the people on the city council. And they had, you know, like 800 people show up for this thing. They saw the thing. And then she said, afterwards, we had a lot more support. And even the police were much more polite on the picket lines than they had been before. And I think that that's a wonderful little story. But I think it also says that culture sometimes wins hearts in ways that all of our arguments don't. And so it's really important. And the ILG was really good at that. It's really important to bring in the song and the dance.
Well, I think that's absolutely the truth. And I think the other part that I heard from that, and, you know, everything's always about what the way you hear it. But the other thing I heard from that is there aren't enough people exposing the average person, the cops on the picket line or the city fathers. There aren't enough people exposing them to the truth. And as a person who's just a tag along on this Rick Smith Show thing, that's what Rick's doing, you know, is that whole, okay, we want you to meet Judy and know exactly what she knows, and we want you to meet that fabulous guy Phil that we just spoke to, and know what they know, because then when you know it, you're going to feel like those cops on the picket line.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. I think we have to do a much better job. I do a radio show here in Kansas City, the Heartland Labor Forum, and that's our hope, that, you know, if they hear these stories of working people, that it's going to make people understand a little more what it's all about.
Well, we need to link our Facebook stuff to your Heartland show because that will be really helpful.
I just interviewed Ed Asner yesterday. I spent an hour with him, and that'll be on our Labor Day show. It was really exciting.
Wonderful. Hey, Judy, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah. You're welcome.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Laura Reyes, Secretary-Treasurer of AFSCME, says the immigration bill passed by the Senate doesn't offer enough protections to U.S. workers and skilled worker visa programs.
The visa program for the higher-skilled workers does not have sufficient protection for U.S. workers to ensure that they have the first shot at getting hired and that employers don't use the program to bring down wages. We also believe that the Senate bill unjustifiably and unnecessarily requires that an additional $30 to $40 billion be spent on border security on the southern border, on top of the ramped up border security the Obama administration has already deployed, and that the Senate bill had already increased with more border security agents, drones, and fencing. But we have to get this done, and right now offers the best opportunity in decades to be on the right side of history.
Reyes is the first woman Secretary-Treasurer of AFSCME and says she's excited to be able to fight for justice for workers as AFSCME fights back against attacks on public worker rights. She says one important issue for her is equal pay for women.
Women still earn less for doing the same work than the male co-workers do, and Congress has a chance to further close the gap by passing the Paycheck Fairness Act, and AFSCME strongly supports this legislation. So this is an exciting time for me to come in and to lead the fight in solidarity and to make sure that we stand up for workers in this country, that we stand up for women and social and economic justice.
Federally contracted low-wage workers are on the move again in Washington, D.C. They plan a strike, protests, and civil disobedience at the Ronald Reagan Building and the old post office pavilion. It's a protest against wage theft as the workers call on President Obama to guarantee a living wage and a voice on the job for federally contracted workers. 2 million workers, many of them low-wage, work for the federal government through private contractors. Oakland, California city employees and BART system workers both launched separate strikes on Monday to bring attention to pay and security concerns. Jesse Russell reports.
Public transit in the Bay Area nearly ground to a halt on Monday as workers called a strike against the Bay Area Transit Authority. In addition to the transit strike, thousands of Oakland City employees walked off the job over their own stalled contract negotiations. The city workers made substantial concessions to the city during the economic downturn, and the workers have accused Oakland Mayor Jean Kwan of not joining in negotiations. So even though she offered a cost of living increase this weekend, they still decided to strike. SEIU Local 1021 Oakland Chapter President Dwight McElroy told the crowd that the strike was about more than negotiations.
The individuals who are hired at the city of Oakland who have no work rights, who have no health care, who have no benefits. Somebody got to start speaking up and say, you cannot continue to mistreat these individuals.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
There isn't anyone immune from globalization. In fact, the confluence of greed and geography blends seamlessly over all of humanity. As the American workforce has become more sophisticated and smart, corporations have become less agreeable. Of course, there were numerous road signs that led to globalization, and at this point, somewhat improbable that any single cause could be raised from the economic wreckage it has created. However, 1976 may have been a high watermark for the American economy, where a change in the tax code emboldened corporations to move more operations overseas. Where these gutless entrepreneurs once shuttered factories in the Northeast and moved them to southern localities, they were now served up by the U.S. Congress, a world plate, where even to their insatiable greed, the possibilities seem limitless. The assault on American workers continued in the 1980s when the Reagan administration further retooled the tax code to allow foreign investors to set up American subsidiaries, thereby artfully managing the exodus of U.S.-based corporations. The unseemly alliance between Congress and corporations offers little solace to workers, but does shine a perpetual light on the misgivings of unregulated money flowing into the pockets of greedy politicians. Unions, while greatly weakened over the last two decades, continue to mount credible defenses, proposing balance, equity, and fairness for workers over the broader brush of Congress that would have us believe that globalization can regulate itself. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Minute is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
People's Tour for America.
WorkersRadio.com. Pat stepped away. My wife's a little tired. The schedule that we've been keeping, just, you know, grueling. As we've traveled across the country, some 8,000 miles to this point, numerous cities, it's beginning to take its toll. And fortunately, there's enough of us to take turns driving. There's enough of us to pick up when someone needs a little hand. So that's what we're doing tonight during the program. And again, we're talking about when we were in Kansas City. You know, earlier we talked about the auto industry, and we got to see the auto plants, and later we're going to talk about the garment industry. But, you know, as we walked away from the UAW hall there in Kansas City, they directed us to the original Ford plant in the area. And, you know, still standing are the smokestacks, still standing are a number of the buildings where those first workers, where they worked and they fought for better wages, hours, and conditions. And we got to go by. And one of the things that really struck me as we went through that area that used to be an industrial powerhouse, where this country manufactured the bombers and the tanks and all of the things that we needed during World War II, all of the things after World War II that made us the industrial superpower of the world. As you look around at the skeletons left by the wayside due to our insane trade policies, I could only feel sad. I could only feel angry, but empowered to do something about it. You know, as you look at these hollowed out shells of our industrial capacity, our hollowed out shells of the wealth and the might of the nation. Here's the thing. We didn't lose it. You know, as somebody who's been in a number of fights over my lifetime, I've lost my fair share, but you always fight back. When I look at what happened to our industrial base, there was no fighting back. We simply gave it away. And that's what's really frustrating. You look at our insane trade deals. You look at the NAFTAs and the Columbias and the Panamas and soon to be the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You look at all this stuff, and they're all designed to do one thing. And it's all right in line with the Reagan vision. The Reagan vision of turning this nation into a service-based economy. And, you know, people my age heard that a lot. We're going to have the nice, clean office jobs. We're all going to get a corner office to push papers across. How's that working out for most people? Because, you know, when I look around and the people that we've met on this tour, we are that Reagan vision. We are the service-based economy that they envisioned. And with it, the poor wages, the poor conditions. And, you know, as we've been talking about on this tour, taking us back 100 years, taking us back to the days of the company store, taking us back to the days of script. The question then becomes, what do we do about it? You know, as we go across the country and we see the hollowed out industrial base, we see homes that used to house families that are deteriorating and falling down, roads and bridges that are crumbling because we haven't invested, because we haven't forced our leaders to do what's right. And what have we created? Well, we've created the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization. And I guess that's something to be proud of. But I think I would rather be proud of having the world's best education system. I think I would rather be proud of having the mighty industrial base that for over 100 years this nation enjoyed. Maybe I would enjoy having the world's best health care, treating our seniors better than anyone in the world. The sad reality is we don't have those things anymore. We've given away our industrial base. We're chipping away at the social safety net, the retirement systems that have been in place, and we've completely walked away from investing in the future. And why? Well, a number of things. We need more tax cuts for the very wealthy. We need more tax cuts for multinationals. And that comes at a price. And the price we've seen, you know, going through some of these big cities. Because, you know, if you don't know your way around, like we've gotten lost a number of times, and you end up in places where you go, wow, how did we get here? And not just how did we get here in the RV and the caravan as we go across the country, but how did we get here as a nation? How did we let this happen? And I guess it's simple. We've been divided, we've been pitted against each other, and we've been sold false ideals. This ideal that free trade is the best solution, this ideal that capitalism is the only way we can succeed as a nation, this idea that hooray for me and the heck with everyone else, I got to tell you, that's not the nation that I grew up believing in. That's not the nation that my mother told me about. That's not the nation that I loved. I love a nation that stands by each other, not tearing each other down. I stand for community, people working together. And, you know, we've been finding that all across the country. People who are sticking together, people who are saying, you know what, I am my brother's keeper. And together, we can do amazing things. But the sad reality is we're divided. We're divided by angry, divisive politics. By billionaires who, well, fund tons of attack ads, who fund both political parties, and I think for the sole purpose of being divided, so that we get nothing done, so that we think, I'm just going to throw up my hands. I had this great conversation the other morning when we were getting ready to go over to the Eisenhower Museum. And the guy I talked to, you know, an older gentleman who politically all over the map, but you could tell he was a Fox News consumer because everything was a talking point. And as soon as you got past that talking point, you said, hey, well, what about this? There was no answer. You know, he threw up to me, you know, unions destroyed the country. And then you go through and you go, well, give me an example. And they always threw up the steel industry or the auto industry. And the steel industry wasn't destroyed in this country because of workers. It was destroyed because of bad decisions by management, of the failure to invest in their business. Instead of investing in new technology, they bought golf courses. Instead of investing in training their workforce, they bought hotels. And while they were competing with the Japanese and the Germans, they were competing with antiquated 100-year-old technology. That's the reason that we lost part of the steel industry. And the other part is that they wanted it. It was cheaper overseas. Wages, conditions were different. That's where they wanted to be. And again, you know, it had nothing to do with the workforce. And then they throw up the auto industry. And coming from a guy who was a defense contractor, worked for a defense contractor his entire life, angry that the workers at GM and at Chrysler actually did okay. But here's the thing. Once I explained to him that, you know what, for the first time, at least in my knowledge, for the first time in history, the workers who went through bankruptcy, they kept their dignity. They kept a stake in what was to come. The bankruptcy judge didn't just wipe it all out and say, well, you know what? So sad, too bad, you're out of a pension. Like the bankruptcy judge did in the Patriot Coal situation. That's the reason the conservatives and the right wing are so crazy. Those auto workers, those guys like we talked to today, they kept a stake. They kept their pension, or at least some of it. So when you hear the other side of this and you see these stories, which is why we're going across the country exploring this stuff. And look, by no means are we getting as much as we would want, because you could spend weeks and months in each one of these communities. But we couldn't. And we're going to take a quick break right back from the road. The People's Tour for America. Stick around and listen to the Rick Smith Show. We'll be right back.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Laura Reyes, Secretary Treasurer of AFSCME, says the immigration bill passed by the Senate doesn't offer enough protections to U.S. workers and skilled worker visa programs.
The visa program for the higher skilled workers does not have sufficient protection for U.S. workers to ensure that they have the first shot at getting hired and that employers don't use the program to bring down wages. We also believe that the Senate bill unjustifiably and unnecessarily requires that an additional $30 to $40 billion be spent on border security on the southern border, on top of the ramped up border security the Obama administration has already deployed, and that the Senate bill had already increased with more border security agents, drones, and fencing. But we have to get this done, and right now offers the best opportunity in decades to be on the right side of history.
Reyes is the first woman Secretary Treasurer of AFSCME and says she's excited to be able to fight for justice for workers as AFSCME fights back against attacks on public worker rights. She says one important issue for her is equal pay for women.
Women still earn less for doing the same work than the male co-workers do, and Congress has a chance to further close the gap by passing the Paycheck Fairness Act, and AFSCME strongly supports this legislation. So this is an exciting time for me to come in and to lead the fight in solidarity and to make sure that we stand up for workers in this country, that we stand up for women and social and economic justice.
Federally contracted low-wage workers are on the move again in Washington, D.C. They plan a strike, protests, and civil disobedience at the Ronald Reagan Building and the old post office pavilion. It's a protest against wage theft as the workers call on President Obama to guarantee a living wage and a voice on the job for federally contracted workers. 2 million workers, many of them low-wage, work for the federal government through private contractors. Oakland, California city employees and BART system workers both launched separate strikes on Monday to bring attention to pay and security concerns. Jesse Russell reports.
Public transit in the Bay Area nearly ground to a halt on Monday as workers called a strike against the Bay Area Transit Authority. In addition to the transit strike, thousands of Oakland City employees walked off the job over their own stalled contract negotiations. The city workers made substantial concessions to the city during the economic downturn, and the workers have accused Oakland Mayor Jean Kwan of not joining in negotiations. So even though she offered a cost of living increase this weekend, they still decided to strike. SEIU Local 1021 Oakland Chapter President Dwight McElroy told the crowd that the strike was about more than negotiations.
The individuals who are hired at the city of Oakland who have no work rights, who have no health care, who have no benefits. Somebody got to start speaking up and saying, you cannot continue to mistreat these individuals.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. On the road, the People's Tour for America. You know, as we headed into Kansas City, Missouri, we're going through Kansas, and a very flat state, Kansas.
Yeah, very.
Came across the Eisenhower Library. In fact, I didn't actually know that's where it was. Every time you hear about Eisenhower, it's always, you know, Gettysburg, since that's where...
That's his retirement home. The only home the Eisenhower family actually ever owned. Dwight, yeah. and his wife ever owned. But he grew up in Abilene, Kansas. Not where he was born. He was born in Texas, moved to Abilene when he was 8. And, in fact, when people said he was from Texas, he would correct them and say, no, I'm from Abilene. But
is it Abilene in Texas? Isn't there an Abilene in Texas?
There may well be. I don't know.
Because when we were going there, I'm going to Abilene, Kansas. I'd only heard of Abilene, Texas. At least I thought.
I never heard of Abilene, Texas.
Huh.
But it was interesting because when he returned from World War II, here's the guy who basically saved the Western world from Hitler. You know, certainly General Patton and other people would maybe take me to task on that, but I'm here and they're not. Anyway, he was asked how he felt about his life, he said, the thing I'm proudest of is that I'm from Abilene, Kansas. So really loved it. All of the properties, all of the buildings owned at his museum are owned by the museum. His home, the home he grew up in, is right there. And the home has not been moved. What was evacuated from the area was the neighborhood.
Evacuated is an interesting word to use. I don't know that I would have used evacuated so much as, well, completely destroyed, taken away.
Well, they weren't all destroyed. A lot of them were they were relocated, though. They weren't destroyed. So the foundation purchased the property and moved the homes, a lot of the homes, where the people wanted to. It was interesting, though. The gift shop is where his elementary school was. Now, that was kind of interesting. But they took the roads away. There's a quiet place on the campus where you can go in and pray. Eisenhower, a very, very prayerful man. He's the one who put "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance. Something I'd like to have taken out, but that's another story. And his mother was a really religious woman who was a pacifist. In fact, she protested World War One, and people had to defend her because they thought she was un-American because she didn't believe in war.
Now, how dare you question war? You know, especially when your son's, you know, the guy leading it.
Well, he wasn't the guy leading it in the time of World War One. He was just a kid, but she was not happy that he went to West Point. And I think the telling story of this was he went to West Point because it was free. He and his brothers had all made a pact to educate each other, so they all worked really hard. He had left high school right after high school, applied to the Naval Academy first. Imagine if he'd become a Navy officer instead of an Army officer. Applied to the Naval Academy first, and they rejected him because he was too old. And one of the reasons he was an older student was because he had taken a couple of years off to help his brothers earn money to help his brothers go to school. And then he got a chance when he went to West Point. He got a free education. What a difference from the George W. Bush story. Eisenhower didn't grow up anywhere near a silver spoon. Both of his parents went to college for 2 years. That's where they met. His father became a refrigeration engineer.
Through a correspondence course, which I found interesting.
Yeah, well, that's how he got his final diploma. But he did go. Those two years he went to school was an engineering, for engineering, too. And they were hardworking people and not so much W. Father, the head of the CIA, the committee to reelect the president, you know, that group that brought us Watergate. And I don't know, really different stuff. His mom looked nothing like Babs either.
No, in fact, the home, you know, my daughter was, as we walked through and toured his childhood home, remarked at how small everything was and how small the bedrooms were, made her rethink the size of her own bedroom.
I loved the front parlor that no one was allowed to sit in. It was just for company. It was literally the size of some people's bathrooms. It was that small. How'd you like the Bible? I loved the Bible open to the page where Dwight Eisenhower's birth was written in.
Yeah, they kept all the birth records. But that's, you know, what people did back then.
I know, but to see the handwriting that a day or so after he was born scrawled his name into the Bible, you know, pretty neat. It was really neat. It's also got everything is original to the family. I don't think I've ever been in any historic site where everything was original. Ever. Ever, ever.
The question is, you know, how long is that stuff going to last then? I mean,
well, they have it climate controlled, and, you know, there's no reason it shouldn't last as long as it can last. The thing that's going to fall apart and has already started is Mamie Eisenhower's wedding gown is deteriorating, and there's nothing they can do about it because she left in her will that it be on display forever, that it never be put away. So her wedding gown is out to the light, and you saw where some of the ribbons he got had been put away and replaced by pictures because the ribbons were falling apart. So I guess if you marry Dwight Eisenhower, you're pretty. And that wedding gown was gorgeous. Gorgeous.
Yeah, what struck me is that, you know, how the vast majority of the museum and the library wasn't dedicated to him so much as it was to World War II and a lot of the events that led up to his presidency. I mean, there was a little bit, but not as much as I would have thought. And having visited the Bush Library, where it was a rewriting of the Bush presidency, you know, making him the greatest president in the history of the world, a lot different in my view.
Well, I think, first of all, nothing ever happened in George Bush's life that was a success until, and asterisk this, his presidency, because I don't think that was a success either. But he did steal two elections, and that made him president. And so with Eisenhower, his presidency was almost, oh, yeah, an afterthought to really the greatest moments of his career, D-Day, of course, and seeing the table where D-Day was planned. Literally, the hair stood up on the back of my neck, and I've heard people say that before, but I think that was the only time I've ever experienced that. That was chilling and amazing. And to think about all those people gathered around, you know, Churchill and the rest of them gathered around that table, planning and knowing that thousands of people would die on both sides for this assault on Normandy Beach, Omaha Beach, making that planning just amazing. I loved it. I loved being there. Loved it.
Yeah. The thing about his election, that you fast forward to today and you go, could you imagine announcing on June 4th that you're going to run for president?
And then winning?
And then taking a couple weeks vacation? And then winning? I mean...
Yeah, he didn't start campaigning, they said, until Labor Day. Had to wait for the Republican convention, which was in August.
Maybe that would be a good thing to start thinking about. These two-year campaigns,
Well, they have laws like that in other countries. In the United Kingdom, you can't campaign until it's time. You also can't buy an election. You're not allowed to buy advertising. You have to use the publicly funded advertising venues.
And I had asked, you know, since you brought up that, you know, because the thing that stuck out to me most about the Bush Library was walking right in the entrance and seeing the wall of money. Or as they called it, the Wall of Freedom.
And I
still want to know what it took to get on that wall. How much money it took to be donated to get on that wall. And the Eisenhower one, and there was no wall of money. And I'm not quite sure I can't remember exactly what the guy said, but I think the biggest donation was something like $50,000.
I think that might have been Truman. I don't know if that was Eisenhower. I know that Truman's largest donation was $50,000. And Independence, Missouri, gave him the land. So the land might have been the $50,000 donation. I don't know, but certainly not. And Truman, of course, started his library himself. Well, I guess that was the other thing about Eisenhower. He did, too. Eisenhower started it in, like, 1947. Came home from the war and thought, well, I got all this war stuff. Got to put it somewhere. It was a pretty important war. Maybe people will want it. And they started the whole museum idea long before he became president.
Yeah. I always get this email running around that, you know, that one of the reasons Eisenhower started the museum was so that people wouldn't forget the Holocaust. And there were several pictures. There were a number of pictures from the Holocaust and what they found in Germany. I got to be honest. Towards the end of it, I kind of took my daughter and moved along. So that, you know, she didn't see that. I mean, she saw some of it, but it, you know, how much of it does she need to see?
As we're
rolling along down the road on the People's Tour for America, scheduling calls, kids screaming in the background, all kinds of things going on.
Oh, they are screaming now and crying, I think, too. That this is the part of the trip that really shows what an ambitious task you came up with, Rick.
Shame on me.
I feel like, you know, right now as we hear the screaming and the slapping coming out of the back of the thing and the phones ringing and everything, I think of the spoof in Aladdin. Did you see the movie Aladdin?
Yeah.
When Aladdin all of a sudden turns into the two commentators who are calling the parade in New York, the Macy's Day Parade. Oh, June, did you see that lovely float go by? You know, it's kind of like this, yeah.
And Allie throws a right haymaker. Alex goes down.
Comes up swinging. In the meantime, Sam is trying to read a book and pushing her glasses back up her nose.
While kicking both of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Going to take a quick break from the road. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Laura Reyes, Secretary-Treasurer of AFSCME, says the immigration bill passed by the Senate doesn't offer enough protections to U.S. workers in skilled worker visa programs.
The visa program for the higher-skilled workers does not have sufficient protection for U.S. workers to ensure that they have the first shot at getting hired and that employers don't use the program to bring down wages. We also believe that the Senate bill unjustifiably and unnecessarily requires that an additional $30 to $40 billion be spent on border security on the southern border, on top of the ramp that border security the Obama administration has already deployed, and that the Senate bill had already increased with more border security agents, drones, and fencing. But we have to get this done, and right now offers the best opportunity in decades to be on the right side of history.
Reyes is the first woman Secretary-Treasurer of AFSCME and says she's excited to be able to fight for justice for workers as AFSCME fights back against attacks on public worker rights. She says one important issue for her is equal pay for women.
Women still earn less for doing the same work than the male co-workers do, and Congress has a chance to further close the gap by passing the Paycheck Fairness Act, and AFSCME strongly supports this legislation. So this is an exciting time for me to come in and to lead the fight in solidarity and to make sure that we stand up for workers in this country, that we stand up for women and social and economic justice.
Federally contracted low-wage workers are on the move again in Washington, D.C. They plan a strike, protests, and civil disobedience at the Ronald Reagan Building and the old post office pavilion. It's a protest against wage theft as the workers call on President Obama to guarantee a living wage and a voice on the job for federally contracted workers. 2 million workers, many of them low-wage, work for the federal government through private contractors. Oakland, California city employees and BART system workers both launched separate strikes on Monday to bring attention to pay and security concerns. Jesse Russell reports.
Public transit in the Bay Area nearly ground to a halt on Monday as workers called a strike against the Bay Area Transit Authority. In addition to the transit strike, thousands of Oakland City employees walked off the job over their own stalled contract negotiations. The city workers made substantial concessions to the city during the economic downturn, and the workers have accused Oakland Mayor Jean Kwan of not joining in negotiations. So even though she offered a cost of living increase this weekend, they still decided to strike. SEIU Local 1021 Oakland Chapter President Dwight McElroy told the crowd that the strike was about more than negotiations.
The individuals who are hired at the city of Oakland who have no work rights, who have no health care, who have no benefits. Somebody got to start speaking up and saying, you cannot continue.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Claustrophobia, hypochondria, xenophobia, rolled up into one. Just saying your car, baby, mine, and we won't bother it.
Supervisor here at the Presidential Library.
I look at this, and, you know, having just been to the Bush Library, I look at completely different ways of presenting the time that each person spent in office and the time around it. And I have to give you credit. This is a fantastic, fantastic library.
Well, thank you very much. And I think you did hit upon something, and that is that all these 13 presidential libraries, the ones that fall under the National Archives, really do have their own personality that I think reflects that president's personality.
That could explain a lot.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, a lot of, and I want to talk a little bit about his time. There's a lot of time spent on World War II, which there should be. But, you know, during the Eisenhower presidency, there was some space in the museum that caught my attention. You know, the fact that, you know, he invested in roads and bridges, and he invested in public welfare. He invested in NAFTA. There seemed to be an awful lot of investment. And for a Republican president, you know, gauging on what's going on now, I think that's something to be pointed out, that he did invest heavily in the country.
Yeah, there's definitely a difference, I think, between Eisenhower and a lot of modern Republicans in that regard. And what's interesting with some of that investment, particularly the interstate highway system, goes back to things that he experienced in the military. Right after World War I, Ike volunteered for the first transcontinental motor convoy. And they drove a fleet of Army trucks from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco, California. It took 58 days. They averaged 6 miles a day. But it demonstrated the need for a better national road system, and that made a huge impression on Ike. And then also experiencing the Autobahn in Germany following World War II. But I think it's just a good example of that earlier experience translating to something he did as the president. And a lot of that infrastructure he wanted to improve just to improve commerce so that the economy would grow and there'd be more jobs. You know, he also got the St. Lawrence Seaway built in addition to the interstate. And so it really was about improving that infrastructure and strengthening the economy.
I think General Knox got those cannons from Ticonderoga to Washington faster than that. I think they went faster than 6 miles a day.
Well, literally run it faster than that now. So.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah,
absolutely is. And, you know, part of, you know, what I liked about the display here is, it, to me, as I experienced it, and, you know, you had said earlier as you were giving us the tour that, you know, at some point in the future things will all be digitized and people will want to do things online. And just walking through this, you go, you can't possibly get this experience with something like this online. It's just the entire display to me was important.
I agree. And I think that there is just a wow factor from seeing the original item, that artifact, that document, whatever, that you can't reproduce digitally. And so I think there will always be a place like the Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum.
Now, when he first became president, he had 9 millionaires and a plumber.
Yeah, that was kind of the joke. A guy named Martin Durkin, who I believe was the head of the Plumbers Union, as I recall, and the only Democrat on the cabinet, and didn't last long. I think he felt sort of out of place with all these rich guys, admittedly. But it was Eisenhower's attempt to have, you know, that kind of balance on his cabinet.
And the man who replaced him, I believe, was the shortest cabinet secretary of labor, but the man who replaced him was the longest, and he did a lot of what Durkin wanted to do but couldn't speak the language.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting labor appointment was a fellow, I believe Joseph Wilkins was his name, who was African-American, an assistant secretary of labor, and was the first African-American to actually sit at a cabinet meeting while his boss was out of the office. And so that's another first under the Eisenhower administration.
Did you see the picture of the guy in at the 1952 convention who looked just like President Obama? Did you see that?
No, I didn't. I had fallen so far behind at the beginning because literally I could spend days here. But I had fallen so far behind, I had to rush up, and some of it I missed. But I will go back, and most certainly I'll see that.
Well, I wanted a picture of it for the birthers. There's a relative here.
The resemblance is uncanny to President Obama, and he's wearing sort of a Uncle Sam top hat. But speaking of birthers, you know, Eisenhower was born in Texas in 1890. Texas did not begin issuing birth certificates until 1908, and someone actually raised that issue in 1952 about Eisenhower's birth certificate, and so the county where Denison, Texas is located actually issued Ike a birth certificate.
So. Isn't that a riot?
That's like I say, the more things change, you know, the more they stay the same.
I wonder if Donald Trump knows that.
No. And it wouldn't matter. I mean, you know, it just is what it is. But in looking at this beautiful grounds, you know, how many people a year do you get to come through the Eisenhower Museum and Library, and have you seen an increase in interest? Because this is a beautiful facility.
You know, we have. We get about 160,000 a year, and that's way up from even 7 or 8 years ago. A lot of that's due to both a kind of a renewed appreciation for Eisenhower and also the fact that we're offering more public programs than we used to. We really want to. Our director, Carl Weisenbach, wants to really open this up to the public. And so we have put on a lot more public programs than we did in the past, and that helps attract people to our campus.
Now, his house, which we went in his boyhood house, which is right where it stood, but the neighborhood is gone. Was there any problem when they took the neighborhood out?
You know, not that we're aware of. There weren't. We're at the far south end of town, and so it wasn't a real big residential neighborhood. There was still a house behind the Eisenhowers and one east of the museum building and a few on this side of the campus where we're speaking in the library, and they did take those properties and either moved the homes or bought the homes outright. But it did, it's probably unfortunate that it in effect erased Ike's neighborhood, but that home is on its original location, and the streets have been filled in. It used to be on the corner.
Can you tell us a little bit about the fact that, I mean, I'm a history crazy nut, and I have been in a lot of places. I don't think I've ever been in a place where everything belonged to the family that lived there.
Yeah, and it's interesting. When the Eisenhowers gave that home to the Eisenhower Foundation, which began towards the end of World War II, the stipulation was you can have this home, but everything remains as it was when Ida Eisenhower, Ike's mother, died. And I think maybe for the Eisenhower boys, that was kind of a way of preserving that memory of their mother. But they really did, you know, leave everything to this institution. And Eisenhower, you know, donated almost everything from his professional and military life and political life. And so it really is an amazing collection of, you know, one American family's belongings.
Especially because he had kids. You know, you think that, you know, some of the things your dad had that were really special, you'd think that you'd like to pass them down, but they're all, I guess the nice thing is they can't get lost.
Yeah, that's right.
You can always come visit. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, but as I go through here, and we hope to go back a little bit more, you know, we looked at the house, and, you know, my daughter said, you know, look how small the rooms are. I mean, it's a completely different lifestyle. And, you know, we'd gone through part of the museum where they had the TV, or I think one of the one lady told me that when Ike took presidency, I guess like 8 or 9% of the population of the country had a television set. By the time he left, they had almost 90%. I mean, you saw a boom in the middle class, and I think a lot of that had to do with policies of the New Deal and of FDR, but also of Eisenhower as well.
Yeah, that's right. And one thing is interesting with Ike and the New Deal, of course, many people assumed that having the first Republican president in 20 years, you know, he would try to reverse the New Deal. But Eisenhower had an interesting perspective on it. You know, he grew out here. You know, Abilene was really one of the original Wild West towns, particularly late 1860s, early 1870s. Eisenhower met a lot of the people who had actually lived that history. He always had this fascination with the Old West, read lots of Western novels, that kind of thing. And he was born, the year 1890 was the year that the Census Bureau declared the frontier closed. And Eisenhower, in some interesting correspondence with a friend of his named Bradford Chenoweth, who was a very conservative, you know, anti-New Deal Republican, and they would have this kind of philosophical back and forth in their correspondence. They had known each other in the Army. But Eisenhower talked about how since the frontier had disappeared, and with it the land and kind of the hope and opportunity that it once represented was gone, that the federal government had to step in and play that role. And so Ike did not really attempt to roll back much of the New Deal. And again, much to the disappointment of a lot of his supporters.
I often quote, you know, from a letter that he wrote to his brother Edgar about unemployment and the Farm Bill and labor unions and Social Security and all those things that much look like the Republican Party that he said wouldn't exist at the time, if you remember the letter.
He said any party that attempted to abolish those things would be stupid and that they would no longer exist. Edgar was the most politically conservative of his brothers.
And now the Democrats are talking about eradicating some of those things. I wonder what presidents even 40 years ago would think of, you know, current climes. And have you thought about inviting the current Congress to walk through?
We do get, you know, some come out this way. And, you know, it's just, you know, we're a little bit off the beaten track from Washington. But we do have, I'd say, really good interest from both U.S. senators that represent Kansas and our local, you know, congressional representative. I think they're all very interested in the Eisenhower legacy and, you know, are proud that Ike's from Kansas.
It's interesting, his passion for peace. I think of Einstein, too, who played such a role in war and then had such a passion for peace. And you see so much of that in this museum. Is that a universal understanding of Eisenhower? Do you get people who come here and say, hey, wait a minute, I didn't know that he said all those things. If you want security, if Americans want security, they could go to prison, was a paraphrase of what he said.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, most people think of Ike, you know, as a military figure, and so they usually don't associate that, you know, with peace, you know, right offhand. But yeah, he really was, and, you know, his background's very interesting. He comes out of the River Brethren tradition, which was a Mennonite sect, which was pacifist. And his mother remained a pacifist, Ida. She later became a Jehovah's Witness, and they are also, I believe, a pacifist sect. In fact, kind of an unexplored part of her history is she opposed the First World War, and she did so publicly in Abilene, to where some more prominent Abilene figures actually had to intervene on her behalf because she was drawing the attention, you know, of like the state attorney general anyway. And so that was, you know, very much something that Ike grew up with. And she was, you know, opposed, not as vehemently as opposed as some people thought to him going to West Point, but she was, you know, disappointed that he was going to become a soldier.
You told me an interesting story that was similar to my family, where the kids helped each other go to college, and eventually Ike went to West Point because it was a free education.
That's right. He was really looking primarily for a free education, and the fact that it was military, you know, was kind of secondary, although he said it was really a natural fit given his interest in military history. And he also said, you know, it was a chance to continue playing sports. Once he got to West Point, I think, you know, the importance of what that service would mean made a big impression on him. But it wasn't his, you know, priority coming out of high school by any means.
And the role he played in bringing peace to such a war-torn world is, you know.
Well, and of course, you know, as we discussed earlier, the Republicans' campaign slogan in 52 was Korea, corruption, and communism. And Eisenhower, in a speech in Detroit in October of 52, made what became a famous promise that if elected, I shall go to Korea. And just given his stature as a military figure, that really did give him a big bump in the polls. And so after the election, he went to Korea first week of December in 1952 and kind of got the lay of the land and decided it wasn't worth pursuing and had an armistice, you know, 6 months later.
What do you think he'd think about a war that occupation that's gone on for 60 years or...
Well, you know, I'm reluctant to speak for him, but you really have to wonder. I mean, just given what he did in Korea, that I think Ike, you know, would be just very circumspect in, you know, launching an invasion or, you know, trying to maintain an, you know, occupation of a country. He was just so wary of those kinds of, you know, entanglements, as George Washington said, that it'd really be interesting if he were here to hear what he would do.
I often wonder about some of those things. We can bring it to Iraq or Afghanistan or any of that as well. One of the things that the lady I spoke to said that I found really fascinating is that he announced he was going to run for president in June of 1952.
Yeah, I believe the date was June 4th. He came out here to Abilene. I mean, everybody knew it was coming, but he made the official announcement. And then he came over here and actually broke ground for the museum that you could visit today. The convention is then, I think, August. And then immediately after the convention, he goes on vacation for 2 weeks and then begins campaigning finally on Labor Day of 1952.
But it could never happen today. But he was Ike. I mean, he was the guy.
With that kind of personal popularity, I guess you could do it. But.
Yeah, because my grandparents had talked about the end of World War II, and my grandfather was always spoke highly of Eisenhower, even though he was more of a Democrat than a Republican, but always spoke very highly of him. So, you know, as you go back and you look at those years, I'm taken back to that period of just huge prosperity. Where you saw a growing middle class. My grandparents were able to buy a house, and a lot of people's grandparents at that point were as well. And, you know, I go back to those policies, and I wonder where, you know, how we ended up in the wrong direction from that.
You know, another thing that's interesting that I wonder about is all these women, my mom, one of them, the Rosie the Riveters, they went home, and the husbands needed work, and they came back from the war, and they weren't the... I mean, we were building destroyers in a couple of weeks that had taken 18 months. And how did, I guess Truman was the first person who had to deal with that, but certainly there was threats of great depressions on the horizon if something wasn't done. And I mean, we went rather quickly through the end of the exhibit, but is there much about what Eisenhower did to stave off that? Was that where building the interstate highway system and that stuff came in?
Yeah. Partly for economic stimulus, that was definitely on his mind. One thing that was really stretching the economy around the time Ike was elected was the Korean War and the defense budget. And that's one reason he wanted to wind the war down, was just so you could, you know, reduce those defense expenditures, which he also thought were causing inflation. And inflation was always Ike's biggest economic concern, was that, you know, eating away at the savings, particularly of older Americans. Right after World War II, Eisenhower was primarily occupied with demobilization, you know, which then, of course, just contributed to the employment problem back here in the States. But, yeah, President Truman got the deal, really kind of take the brunt of that right after the war.
Yeah, I mean, it's the stimulus thing. I mean, you know, as I was walking through the end, as we were rushing out, you know, you saw the... You know, you saw NASA, you saw the welfare programs, you saw the health, the programs, and all of that stuff. that, you know, I'm seeing us moving, or trying to move away through with austerity. So I gotta ask the question now, with all this sequester and all the stuff going on there, how much have you seen cuts coming back to here, and how much federal money do you get, and how much with the sequester that's just happened, how much does that harm you here?
I'm reluctant to, in my position, to address NARA policy.
You've had furloughs or anything like that.
We have been affected by sequester, and we have not, as an agency, had any furloughs yet, fortunately.
That is great, though, that they haven't, because that this is the point of this trip is to highlight the history of the United States as common people lived it, and to have our historians sequestered would really make me crazy.
Well, it has been government-wide, but again, fortunately, it has not hit the National Archives yet as hard as it has hit some other agencies. One thing in terms of the economy with Ike, and it's something that President Truman did too, they both had three balanced budgets, and for them to have your fiscal house in order was just, the way you're supposed to do things. So that's just an interesting contrast with modern presidents.
Did he raise taxes at any point during his presidency? Was there a tax raising goal?
No, but he did not. He would not lower taxes. He still wanted those higher revenues.
Taxes were high when he was president.
It was 92%.
That's right, the top rate. Yeah, can't get much higher.
So let me ask you the last question I've got, and we really appreciate you having us here. And when you took this position, what did you learn here? What's your personal favorite thing here?
Oh, that's a great question. I was generally acquainted with Ike. I actually grew up in Kansas. Had not really, Eisenhower was not a specialty of mine in terms of the history I study. I think just learning the scope of Eisenhower's abilities in terms of his intelligence, his decision-making ability, just his basic humanity, his concern with peace and that sort of thing. I think that was the biggest surprise, just finding, because there's this stereotype of Eisenhower as just kind of this do-nothing, avuncular, golf-playing president. But when you get the opportunity to look at the record up close, as I have, you see that he's really completely the opposite of that stereotype. And I think that's probably been the biggest thing to me personally.
Well, still waters run deep.
Yeah. No, I'm looking forward to going back. What should we focus on before we leave?
Oh, gosh. The post-presidential years are interesting to me. Ike was a ex-president for 8 years, and we cover some of that in the museum. And really, was in that role as an elder statesman and advising Presidents Kennedy and Presidents Johnson and of course Nixon there towards the end. So Eisenhower had an interesting life, from the beginning to the end.
Tim, we greatly appreciate your time and having us come in. I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break from the road. The People's Tour for America. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
Get up and take your money. All they want to do is get up and take your money.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It goes back to the fundamentals, intoned a Wall Street analyst. The economy is improving. Improving for whom? By fundamentals, he means the high-flying stock market, booming corporate profits, and top executive pay. Those are signs of an economy that is top-heavy, not healthy. In fact, our economy is teetering dangerously because it's not sustained from below by a strong middle class. Economist Paul Krugman notes that far from improving, our economy remains in a low-grade depression. Of course, that thermometer zooms to a high grade if you're among the millions of Americans who are jobless, working for low wages, or able to get only part-time temporary employment. Yes, the unemployment rate has ticked down, but not because of any jump in job creation. Rather, the dismal lack of hiring has become so discouraging that many people simply give up the hunt, which magically removes them from the ranks of the unemployed. Most Congress critters clearly don't care about America's middle-class jobs depression. The White House cares, but doesn't treat it as the crisis it is, so nothing happens. The only jobs push we've had is the stopgap effort by the Federal Reserve to pump enough money into the economy to keep unemployment from worsening. But rather than push harder, Ben Bernanke, head of the central bank, recently sounded retreat. He, too, uses the faulty unemployment statistic as a crutch to claim improvement. The jobless rate, he says, could drop to 7% next year, so the Fed's stimulus will no longer be needed. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's shameful. Even if that was the true rate, 7% equals 11 million unemployed Americans and many millions more who would still be underemployed. From Bernanke to Congress, all government officials who shrug their shoulders and give up on helping that many Americans should themselves be made jobless. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Check out the website, therichsmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at therichsmithshow.com.
So what did you think of the interview with the guy from the Eisenhower Museum?
I loved him. He was one of the 35 people I've tried to ask to marry me on this trip.
Another one?
Yeah, yeah.
I got a whole long list of that.
I know. Most of them are historians, so I'm starting to see a trend.
Yeah, there's a trend.
Yeah, I thought he was really neat. He had worked for the General Archives up until about 6 years ago when he signed on as the deputy director of the Eisenhower Museum. And it was pretty fun just being able to walk through the museum with him. You know, frankly, I've never really had that experience before. Certainly the Bush Library, nobody escorted us through. And I think that might have been because we were talking to the guy from the archives who knew the truth. And it might have just been too darned humiliating to walk through the fabricated museum built by the Bush supporters when you actually knew the truth, you know, and so you'd have to actually stand there and stare at your feet way too long.
I wanted to get hit more of an opinion base because, you know, he's the guy who spent a good portion of his life studying Eisenhower, and, you know, because I call him the socialist president because today, you know, he's an absolute... He'd be a pinko commie in the right-wing world. What would Eisenhower have thought of no transportation bill, no funding for education, you know, the things that have been going on? What would his view have been of the current Republican Party? I didn't ask that, but I wonder.
Well, I think we can look to his final speech, his farewell speech as president, and I think he would be absolutely certain with no-bid contracts to Halliburton and the our forces in foreign countries being one-half mercenary. For every member of the armed forces we have in a foreign conflict right now, we have one contractor. The members of our armed forces make about $25,000 a year and have to obey the military uniform code of conduct. The contractors make about $150,000 apiece and have no code of conduct. They can use hollow point bullets. They can go on these quote-unquote turkey shoots that they brag about. There was a Newsweek magazine story written by Jeremy Scahill talking about how these contractors were bragging about shooting innocent people, civilians in the stomachs in Iraq and watching their stomachs explode with these hollow point bullets. I think Eisenhower warned us about being crucified on a cross of iron. And I think he'd say, we have been.
Yeah, I wish we could have spent more time there. And that's the thing with this trip thus far. You know, there are a lot of things that we've saw, that we've seen, a lot of places we've been that, you know, you could just spend days at. And, you know, the Eisenhower Library and Museum, one of those places. Also the Truman Library and Museum. As we were going through Kansas City, we came across, you know, Independence there. And you were going, we got to stop, even though we only had just about an hour there.
Yeah, Independence, Missouri gave the land to President Truman. And when he left the presidency, he had no retirement. That guy needed a union. He had no retirement. He had no income. So he started the Truman Library. One of my favorite pieces in the Truman Library was the globe that was given to Harry Truman by Dwight D. Eisenhower during World War II before the two had any inkling that they would both be presidents. And I think we're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll be back with more of the Rick Smith Show.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
It goes back to the fundamentals, intoned a Wall Street analyst. The economy is improving. Improving for whom? By fundamentals, he means the high-flying stock market, booming corporate profits, and top executive pay. Those are signs of an economy that is top-heavy, not healthy. In fact, our economy is teetering dangerously because it's not sustained from below by a strong middle class. Economist Paul Krugman notes that far from improving, our economy remains in a low-grade depression. Of course, that thermometer zooms to a high grade if you're among the millions of Americans who are jobless, working for low wages, or able to get only part-time temporary employment. Yes, the unemployment rate has ticked down, but not because of any jump in job creation. Rather, the dismal lack of hiring has become so discouraging that many people simply give up the hunt, which magically removes them from the ranks of the unemployed. Most Congress critters clearly don't care about America's middle-class jobs depression. The White House cares, but doesn't treat it as the crisis it is, so nothing happens. The only jobs push we've had is the stopgap effort by the Federal Reserve to pump enough money into the economy to keep unemployment from worsening. But rather than push harder, Ben Bernanke, head of the central bank, recently sounded retreat. He, too, uses the faulty unemployment statistic as a crutch to claim improvement. The jobless rate, he says, could drop to 7% next year, so the Fed stimulus will no longer be needed. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's shameful. Even if that was the true rate, 7% equals 11 million unemployed Americans and many millions more who would still be underemployed. From Bernanke to Congress, all government officials who shrug their shoulders and give up on helping that many Americans should themselves be made jobless.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. From the road, the people's tour for America had to take a quick break there to save the young, the boy from the two girls who were, well, beating him senseless in
torturing
the back.
Him. Yeah. Poor luckily, kid. We have the caboose that travels with us, and we can eject a child and put him in a safe zone or a timeout zone, depending on which one they deserve.
Sometimes you need a break away from everyone, and that's what that was all about. Had to move along.
Is that why Carol's always back there?
Peacefully by herself, yes.
She's missing out on all the fun.
One could argue. But while we were in Kansas City, we had the opportunity to meet Ed Asner. Went to a press conference. He, of course, Lou Grant fame. My kids know him from the movie, what was Up, I think it was called.
Up. He was also Santa Claus in the wonderful movie Elf. With Will Ferrell, where Will Ferrell plays an elf looking for his dad, who happens to be James Caan. I love that movie. I love it. You know, and Asner coming in, going to be in a new film coming out called Père Noël, which of course means Father Christmas. But he fell while making the film, and so he was in a wheelchair when we saw him.
Which I guess, you know, kind of fitting playing FDR.
Yeah, he's doing a one-man show. He's done it for about 3 years now, and he was making an appearance at his old high school. To benefit the United Way in the area. And they predicted they were going to raise about $30,000 with his appearance. Pretty exciting.
Yeah, and you know, like one of the questions that was asked him, you know, why not just write a check for it? And, you know, I liked his answer. You know, it's about bringing people together. It's about community. It's it's about more than just here's a check. It's actually doing something, and I like the answer, and I like the sentiment.
Yeah, he said that checks aren't from his heart, and actions are. And so if he can do an action, that would help. It was really wonderful. The captain of the football team, he played football when he was in high school. The coach of the football team was there, and his son plays for
the Steelers.
Pittsburgh Steelers. Yeah. That was kind of exciting. He brought four football players in who were very big boys. Ed's response to the kids, just looking at him, at those kids, made his body bruise. He said he was grateful he didn't have to play against 280-pound players when he was a kid.
Yeah, the one kid was a sophomore, 284 pounds. You go, wow, that's a big kid.
They told him that if he didn't behave, they were going to tease him about his high school stories. And he said, go ahead, I have no shame. I love that. Fantastic sense of humor. Fantastic sense of humor.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to ask him a couple of questions, and, you know, one of them was about labor and, you know, playing FDR. You know, what would FDR have thought of, you know, the assaults on workers today? And his quote was, you know, was quite telling. You know, without labor unions, you've got dictatorship.
I thought it was really interesting, too, that I haven't seen a single person who's talked about segregation or prejudice as though it was all that bad. I mean, even he said that where he grew up in Wyandotte, Kansas, it was a gentle place to grow up. There was discrimination, but it wasn't hatred. And then he went on later almost to contradict himself and say that there were some really racist kids on the team. He said things he wished he never should have. He knew he shouldn't have it as he got to be an older man, wished he'd never said them, but wasn't this sort of vitriol. And there was a kid on the team that he knew if the coach had heard him, he would have beaten his butt, except he didn't say butt. He said that the coach wouldn't have tolerated that kind of talk. But he did play for an all-white school. He went to a segregated high school.
1947.
Yeah, but
Before Brown versus Board of Education.
But people in Pennsylvania don't know what that's like because Pennsylvania wasn't segregated. So it is something that, you know, Ed Asner, who is by all estimations a liberal, you know, far left leaning guy, grew up in that environment. So you don't have to stay what you grow up.
True.
If you don't want to.
And the other question I asked him, along with a couple other ones, was, you know, why they canceled Lou Grant. And I had known the story, but I wanted to hear it from his lips. Is that, you know, he was talking out against the war, and, you know, that wasn't tolerated.
Yeah, he was very critical of Ronald Reagan's, death squads in Nicaragua and other places. And, yeah, I remember it when it happened, when they canceled Mary Tyler Moore. And we were upset because that was, like, one of our favorite shows. I was a kid growing up and in my early 20s. And they canceled the program because Lou Grant couldn't keep his mouth shut about politics. And he said that the sponsors didn't like it. Sponsors didn't like him criticizing Ronald Reagan.
And what was the quote? How did he say it? If you've got sponsors, you're screwed or something like that?
I have to find it.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I put it on my Facebook page, and you can take a look at the couple of quotes there that we got from Ed Asner on our Facebook page. You know, and as I look at the guy, and you got to give him credit, 80-some years old, what, 84, I think, 83, 84, still spry, still out there, you know, speaking his mind. I liked our time there, even though the kids were a little antsy.
They were really well behaved, actually. I mean, there was no ejecting into the back car during that one. They were very well. You asked him actually several questions. The question I asked, what was he proudest about in the time he'd lived as a member, as a person in the United States? And he said the thing he's proudest of the United States for is the people it creates. He said it creates monsters too, but it creates the labor organizers, first thing he said. He said it creates the teachers who give of their own money. It creates the ministers and clergy and the social workers. He said it's the little people in America who believe in the myth of America and then try to embody it. I loved that. I'm not in love with President Obama, he said, but privatizing anything I think is reprehensible. That was to a question you had asked.
I asked about privatizing the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority. And he, you know, there was this incredulous look on his face, like what?
Yeah, he said, I'm going to have to look into that. Because who in their right mind, I'm adding to this now, but he said, I'm going to have to look into that. Because, like me, who in their right mind would privatize one of the most profitable investments the United States government's ever made?
That's
nobody
a,
in their right mind. Just
that's
somebody,
a good question.
Somebody owned by corporations. That's who would do it. He said he thought that one thing we need to remember about people is that we have Abels, but we also have Cains. And the Cains can rise to the top. He said that we're a family. We are a family of Cains and Abels. We have to be careful of the Cains, but we need to make our family bigger. And when you leave a little family and you become a high school kid, well, you join a football team, and then your family gets bigger. And then you get out, and that we have to keep expanding that brotherhood we feel and loving each other. And it was just really cool to hear this 80-something-year-old guy who had made it. You know, not some tree-hugging hippie freak who was still, like, standing on bridges trying to protest the war of 10 years later after we all failed, but a guy who really made it in the big time, standing there saying that stuff.
And he also got a quick kiss from the principal, which I thought was kind of forward. But
yeah.
I guess when you're 83 years old, you can get away with a few things, take a few liberties, if you will.
When she went to shake his hand, he said, "Hey, I love women. Give me a kiss." Adorable.
Why is that adorable when you're 83, but if you're 20, you get smacked?
It's not adorable when you're 83. It's adorable when you're Ed Asner.
Okay, there
he
you
wouldn't
go.
Have been smacked at 35. He'd have gotten away with it every single time.
But, yeah, you know, I enjoyed our time in Kansas City. In fact, you know, our final...
Food!
Exactly. It was Arthur Bryant's, which when we got there at a good time. We only had to wait about a half an hour. When we sat down, the line was literally out the door and around the corner. I'm sorry, I don't wait an hour for anything.
Well, you're crazy because that was worth
that
it.
I may have.
Yeah, that was totally worth it.
Got an amazing rack of ribs, and it was. It's back to the diet plan when
did
I get back.
Did you notice that, with one exception, all the patrons were white, and every single person working there was black? Did you notice that?
No, I didn't. I actually noticed. You know, the guy in front of me was a black guy with his kid. I thought it was a fairly mixed crowd. I saw a couple of Asians, saw a couple of white people, a couple of Hispanics. You know, as I was walking out, I thought it was a very diverse, because I actually thought about it, going, wow, this is fantastic.
Yeah,
everybody loves ribs.
Everybody does love ribs, but I kind of counted. So I didn't see a lot of what you saw. I saw a very white set of patrons and a very black set of workers, especially the women who were cleaning the tables, the guys sweeping the floor, all the guys cooking. I thought it was a marked difference, and I think that, you know, that's something that happens in our culture that we really need to work on. I think there's still a servile class, and a lot of times it's delineated by race. And I think it'll be a wonderful thing when a couple of white people are sweeping the floors, and and a couple of more black people are in the food line.
But no.
It'll
well,
be nice.
We can work in hope.
Yep.
Anyway, if you've missed any portion of the program, the RickSmithShow.com or People's Tour for America, we're on the road heading down to, well, St. Louis tomorrow. We're going to talk about what we find in the arch city of St. Louis before we head on to Chicago and then more of the way home. Hope you've enjoyed our coverage. Of course, if you missed any of it, the RickSmithShow.com or People's Tour for America. See you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick at therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's
coming. We're expecting to get blue ass cold here as well. I'm hoping, well, throw in some extra covers on the bed this evening. And just trusting in the incredibly expensive space heater to, and a closed door to.